Meeting is called to order, the Committee on Public Safety, Policy, and Finance, today, Friday, March 3, 2006. Clerk, would you take the roll?
Chairman Smith.
Here.
Representative Eastland.
Here.
Cornish.
Here.
Ellison. Hillstrom.
Here.
Johnson. Messwell.
Here.
Murphy.
Here.
Nelson. Newman.
Here.
Tamar.
Here.
Soderstrom.
Here.
Chair notes that we do have a quorum. Committee, we have two bills that we're going to do today. It's not a regularly scheduled day, and again, I will apologize one more time. We'll attempt to not have to do that again throughout the rest of this session, but we are here today, and we're going to be considering two bills. The first one will be House File 2985, Regulation of Protests at Funeral Ceremonies. The second bill will be House File 2846, Johnson J., Eminent Domain, Public Use, etc. There are a number of witnesses on that bill. It would be my hope that we could stay within the confines of a regular committee time frame, that being adjourning around noon with our business completed. However, we are going to complete the calendar regardless of the time. So keep that in mind with any questions. Let's try to be concise, to the point, and brief. Having said that, let's move along then to House File 2985.
Welcome to the committee this morning, Representative Smith. For House Bill 2985, would you like to move what you want to do with that bill?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I would like to move House 2985.
Okay. Do we have a place, or are we just...
The motion then would be to move House File 2985 to the General Register.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, if it pleases the committee, I would like to... I have some brief opening comments. I believe we have a video prepared. I trust that's ready to go. And I will make a few remarks first. I would ask the video, and then I do have one witness as listed on the agenda. Is that all right?
Yeah, Representative Smith, do you have an amendment you want to put the bill in the proper order at this
point? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's why you're sitting there. I do have an amendment. I would first like to offer to get the bill in the shape that it needs to be in, and that would be H2985A1. First of all, I would ask that there be an inclusion. I'd like to orally amend the amendment at line .14. It should read page 1, delete lines 13 to 23 of the original bill. So the amendment, the hard copy amendment, should have the effect of deleting lines 13 through 23 on page 1. So I'd like the amendment to include that language.
Okay, so we'll just call that a friendly amendment by the author. Any objection to that?
And I would move the amendment as amended to get the bill in the shape it needs to be in.
Okay, the amendment 2985 has removed. Any questions on that amendment? All in favor of adding that amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the amendment is adopted. The bill is in the shape that you want it. So why don't you begin with the testimony as you want to proceed.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I would just like to comment first on the bill. And Mr. Chairman and committee, the right of free speech is fundamental to the dignity and the freedom of any individual. But reasonable restrictions have been placed on the exercise of free speech. Commercial speech, for example, such as advertising cigarettes on television, has been limited. We also prohibit dangerous speech, such as yelling fire in a crowded theater. But the most common forms of restrictions on free speech fall into the category of time, manner, or place restrictions. you can, for example, you can give a lecture on any topic in Minnesota's Orchestra Hall, but not during a concert. That's a time restriction. You can protest the wearing of fur, but not by parading naked in public. That is a manner restriction. You can speak out against traffic congestion, but not in the middle of a busy intersection at rush hour. That is a place restriction. When government restricts the time, manner, or place of a kind of speech, there is a three-part test for such restrictions. First, the restriction must be clearly placed in law. Second, they must pursue an aim that is recognized as legitimate. And third, they must be both necessary and proportionate for the accomplishment of that aim. Mr. Chairman and Committee, we are here with this bill to protect families who are going through the hardest parts of their lives from the vilest non-physical attacks that they could endure. That is a legitimate aim. We're here asking that the proponents of the vile speech be moved back 1,000 feet from the funeral. This is proportionate. Whether the law is necessary, I will leave to the news clip I would ask now be played.
Governor Cimpoletti saying he's disgusted by a group of protesters from Kansas who have picketed at funerals of soldiers killed in Iraq. Here's Carol Evans' John Cromer.
It had the trappings of any military funeral, a flag-draped coffin carried by young soldiers. But those who came to say goodbye to Corporal Andrew Kemple had to endure anti-gay protesters.
He went to hell for her sins. It's not too late for you.
Members of a fringe Baptist church in Topeka, Kansas, demonstrated military funerals around the nation, contending American casualties in Iraq are God's judgment on this nation for tolerating homosexuality.
We wanted to drown them out as much as possible.
Kim Bush was among those who mounted a counter-protest and witnessed what happened when Corporal Kemple's mother approached the demonstrators.
The people, like, snarled back at her and said, "You're going to be next. You're going to be in hell with your son next in the body bay.
You made that child, the tormented child he was."
Can't get that image out of my mind of seeing the pain on that poor mother's face.
Governor Pelosi was also on hand in Anoka, and today remarked on how the grieving mother reacted.
She got up at the funeral and expressed to all of us to not respond to hate with hate, but to respond to hate with dignity.
But the governor's ready to respond to hate with a law keeping funeral protesters at bay.
I was appalled by the behavior and message and insensitivity of the protesters at that funeral yesterday.
Senator Don Betzel of Fridley plans to sponsor such a bill.
I was surprised to hear about it. They said it's kind of sad that we have to have a law to do this, but if this is what's happening, we should deal with it.
The senator is reviewing two versions, one that would keep protesters 300 feet away, another making it 1,000 feet.
Having a protest at a funeral, regardless of who the deceased is and regardless of what the issue was, we should not be disrupting funerals.
Now, the proposed laws would make the first offense a misdemeanor, the second offense a gross misdemeanor. Wisconsin and South Dakota have passed similar legislation, and according to USA Today, 13 other states also considering funeral protest bills. And Mike, Wisconsin went with 500 feet for the distance.
Oh, wow. All right, John, thanks very much. John Cromer in the newsroom tonight.
Mr. Chairman and committee, I believe that's it. Now I would like to introduce a witness, if you will, who has some perspective that she would like to have, Ms. Marilee Carlson, mother of Sergeant Michael Carlson.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Carlson. Would you please kind of state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony?
Certainly, Marilee Carlson. And I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today and thank you for our service to the great state of Minnesota. As the mother of a fallen soldier, there are two events that will be with me for the rest of my life. One is the day I was told of Michael's death. The other is the funeral and burial service. My son Michael was granted a funeral full of dignity, honor, and love. Unfortunately, this is not the case for all families. There are people in this country of ours who take for granted the freedoms that have been paid for at an extremely high price. There are people in this country who abuse the freedom of speech we enjoy by using it to purposefully, irreparably harm others. There are people who have no decency or respect for grieving families. Corporal Andrew Kempel and Specialist Benjamin Smith also served their country with courage and honor. However, their parents, Deidre and John, Lenore and James, while surrounded by loving family and friends, will always remember the day of their son's funerals as days of protest and hatred, as a group chose to abuse their freedom of speech by purposefully and maliciously hurting these families. The Westworld group has chosen to take their hatred to military funerals and other funerals throughout the United States, including that of West Virginia coal miners. Sergeant Benjamin Smith of Hudson, Wisconsin, in November, and of course the funeral of Corporal Andrew Kempel last week. All grieving families have the right to lay their beloved family member to rest with dignity and love. In this instance, I firmly believe that the grieving family's rights outweigh the rights of groups whose sole purpose is to disrupt the funeral and cause pain to the family. An article dated March 1st in the Indy Star stated that the Indiana legislature passed a funeral protest bill. It further stated that 15 states are currently considering similar legislation or have passed it, including Wisconsin on February 3rd and South Dakota on the 13th. This Westboro group has disrupted military funerals in 30 states. And here's my concern. Today, this group is protesting at any funeral that will give them attention. Who will become the focus of protests next year, and by what group? We don't seek to stifle the rights of these people to speak. Rather, we seek to protect those who would be irreparably harmed by such vicious actions. Representatives Smith and Severson have proposed similar bills to create a time and space corridor around grieving families at the time of funerals to ensure that their rights are protected. One concern I have is the effective date I saw was August 1st, and I believe most of the states which have passed this legislation have made them effective immediately, most of these because of pending funerals. I pray that we have no more reason to need this legislation, but we need to be prepared to protect these families if the occasion arises. I ask you today to protect the rights of grieving families and pass this bill and enact it as soon as possible so that no other family will have to experience this pain. I ask you to pass this bill in honor of Corporal Andrew Kempel.
Thank you, Ms. Carlson. Representative Smith, do you have any other comments?
Mr. Chairman, I think I would add one, and that is to ask staff, Ms. Pierce, to reference the amendment. Amendment change did contain the date, I believe, and it was based on your memorandum to me, which I've supplied to the committee, dated March 2, 2006. I think you have a I know you have a copy of that, and as does the committee. And, Mr. Chairman, I would ask that document be incorporated in the record of this committee for this hearing, as the amendment was based on the advice of that memorandum.
Okay, that's so noted, Representative.
Ms. Pierce, this is your document, and it contains your thoughts and advice. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, yes, it does, but I would have one amendment. In my memo, I referenced the Perry test. Upon further research, I think that a more stringent test may apply. So I would amend my document to say that when a court issues an injunction that restricts the time, place, and manner of a particular form of expression, because a prior restraint occurs, Instead of asking whether the restrictions are narrowly tailored, a court must ask whether the challenge provisions of the injunction burden no more speech than necessary to serve a significant government interest.
Mr. Chairman, that concludes our testimony, and before I renew my motion, I'm ready for any questions, if you have any, if there are any.
Okay, thank you, Representative Smith. Just by way of information, we should also acknowledge that I think there were four bills or similar bills that were authored. And Representative Dan Severson, who's here, was also the author of a bill. Representative Marty Seifert, I think, also had a bill, and Representative Frank Moll. And so I think we should just acknowledge the fact that there was several initiatives that came forward very quickly when this need was brought to our attention. So, but we're focusing on Representative Smith's bill here today. So I guess that leaves us, are there any questions from the committee that we would like to discuss or have answers to? Okay, Representative Ellison and then Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I want to commend you and all the other authors who've brought forth bills on this bill. Our courts have recognized that a grieving family has a privacy interest at a funeral. And so I want to thank you, and I do intend to support your bill. I just wanted to make the point, though, and put into the record that I think the cost of the bill is that other messages that are not venal, that are not hatred at a funeral, probably can't be allowed either. A support the troops thing. I mean, I think that the bill has to be content neutral. Unfortunately, that is the case. I think people should be able to express themselves, but this kind of message is horrible. But I don't want to give the individuals who are disrupting funerals an opportunity to challenge the law and have it struck down on being overbroad. So I just wanted to say that I think it's important that we have specific times, which the amendment does include, so it's not too overbroad, and specific distances, which is specific and does not regulate the content of a message. And I think that the individuals who are disrupting these funerals are not more important than our First Amendment. And we should all bear in mind that we don't want to hand them a victory by drafting an overbroad bill. So I just want to thank you again, Representative Smith and all the other authors, and want to urge us all to really be careful on this one, because we don't want to unwittingly, trying to do the right thing, end up handing some fairly, you know, wicked people an opportunity for a win. That's all I want to say.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, could you address the wisdom of changing the seat? Maybe you didn't change it, but I know that at some point we talked about 300, and I notice in here it says Wisconsin has 500 and South Dakota has 1,000. What's the difference and why?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, I am going to ask Ms. Pierce to help me on this one. I'll give you the plain English reason, and she can maybe help me out with more specifics, because, frankly, I have relied on committee staff, legal staff on this to get this thing done right and to avoid, or at least, if not avoid, a challenge later on, to explain what we're doing and to try to cover everything, including what Representative Ellison said and what you're probing at now. I don't know what the magic number is feet away from, but personally I thought 300 was too tight, and 1,000 seemed right, and I'd like Ms. Pierce to perhaps lend a little more legal answer on that, if she would, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Pierce?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, as the chairman said, I don't think there is a magic number here in looking at the South Dakota and Wisconsin laws. We're trying to fit it into something that was comparable to those laws. It looks like they had made decisions that would conform with the First Amendment rights. With respect to the South Dakota law, it's 1,000 feet, but they don't have a provision that says with intent to disrupt a funeral service. So I think the amendment here protects another right that the South Dakota law doesn't.
You had a question, Representative Murphy.
And Mr. Chair, 1,000 feet is what? Almost 3 blocks?
Ms. Pierce? 3 football fields.
Okay.
Ms. Pierce? Any other comment there?
No, I agree.
Okay.
We have Representative Newman and then Representative Pimar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Given the nature of this particular bill involving, obviously, the freedom of speech, I think it's pretty important that we make a statement as to what our legislative intent is concerned in the event this matter would be reviewed by a court sometime down the road. And it would be my view that simply because we live in a democracy where we do have the freedom of speech, that does not mean that the government does not have the right to protect its citizens. I've read through this bill, and I've listened to the presentation, and it's my judgment that the state of Minnesota has a legitimate interest in the public safety of its citizens. And for that reason, when I review the restrictions that are in the bill, it seems to me that what Representative Smith has done has struck a very reasonable balance between the freedom of speech and the protection of our citizens. And for that reason, I think it's a legitimate compromise. And I would not think that a court in the future would want to substitute our judgment in terms of our legitimate public purpose for that of their own. And for those reasons, I do support this bill. And I thank Representative Smith for coming forward with it.
Representative Pimar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe this is for staff or Representative Smith. This, our current harassment statutes, would they cover this? Just trying to think of all of the, when we were dealing with clinics that provided abortion, there were, I guess I have two questions. One is whether our harassment statutes cover this, and then the other one is what our, I have a Planned Parenthood clinic in my district that was the scene of a lot of protests and attempts to stop women from going into that clinic, and I don't recall now what the amount of feet that they're prohibited from being in those clinic being protesting by those clinics. Do you have the answer to either one of those questions?
Ms. Barrett?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pimar, I don't have the answer to your second question.
Okay.
But with respect to your first question, some instances may be covered under the harassment law, but there would have to be a pattern established before that so that the person could go to the court and get a restraining order. And once the restraining order has been violated, then there would be a misdemeanor. So it would be after the fact. Versus in this amendment, they could seek to enjoin the conduct before it occurred, or they would get a misdemeanor for that first conduct.
I guess I'm just trying to figure out this Mr. Phelps, who's conducting these protests. I mean, there is a pattern of behavior that crosses jurisdictions, and wouldn't that suffice under current statute?
Ms. Perez?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pimar, I believe the pattern has to be towards the victim in the harassment statute.
Okay.
The other thing that I would mention is that we have a disorderly conduct statute on the books. If I can flip to it quick. The disorderly conduct statute currently prohibits breach of the peace. So if someone were to disturb an assembly, or engage in offensive, obscene, abusive, or noisy conduct in a way that would tend to reasonably arouse alarm, anger, resentment in others, and that's a misdemeanor.
Representative Beamer?
Mr. Chair, so our current law could handle this under the disorderly conduct chapter.
Ms. Perez?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beamer, it could. It's a higher standard here.
What's the higher standard? I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. What's the higher standard?
They would... Let me... One second. They would have to have reasonable grounds to know that it will or will tend to alarm, anger, or disturb others, or provoke an assault or breach of the peace. And in the amendment, it would be just with intent to disrupt the service. It wouldn't necessarily provoke an assault or breach of the peace.
Representative Beamer.
That leads me to my next question then. So the intent to disrupt a funeral procession, can you elaborate? I mean, obviously this was an attempt to disrupt the funeral of Mr. Carlson. If someone was there with a button and was not saying anything, for instance, had some means of protest, but was not yelling or doing the vile things that this group did, would that be considered an intent to disrupt?
Ms. Perez?
I suppose the court would have to decide that, but I'm just trying to see what kind of boundaries we have here. Between free speech and actual behavior that's intentional.
Are you done, Representative? Ms. Perez?
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar. When we were looking at the issue, one of the things that came up, I believe, in the Government Operations Committee was whether this would stop anti-war protesters from coming. That was a concern that they wanted to allow those people in, as well as the Patriot Riders. So this is an attempt to say it has to be with intent to disrupt so that those people could be allowed to come. My other part of the answer would be that...
Mr. Chair, I don't understand that last part.
Representative Beamer?
I apologize.
I'm not quite following what you're saying. So you're saying that people could protest at a funeral as long as they were not disrupting the funeral.
Ms. Perez? We'll let her explain, okay?
Well, I'm trying to get the fine line here because it seems to me that it's in the eye of the beholder. I mean, I'm sure Ms. Carlson would have felt that any kind of activity, going back to speak for you, but I'm sure any activity in form of a protest would have been disruptive to you. Now I'm asking questions all over the place.
Maybe Representative Smith, do you have a comment to this question at all? Is there the fine line or the bright line or whatever it is that we're trying to find here?
Mr. Chairman, you have bright minds on this committee. I was just kind of sitting and listening, but I guess Representative Paymar, we could deal with hypotheticals all day long. I see where you're getting at, and frankly, I think any law we pass ultimately is going to have to be looked at when somebody presses the issue in a courtroom. What better place than a courtroom, however, to determine this button question you've asked, where the button wearer and the non-button wearer would have equal access to that courtroom, equal application of this law, and the expectation that it would be equally applied. So I think ultimately it's going to depend on the size of the button, what it said, if it's a great big one, if it's a little bitty one, and that will be for a judge to decide later on. I don't think we're here talking about buttons in this bill. We're talking about the kind of vile action and speech that we saw.
Representative Newman, did you have a to this point?
To this point,
okay, Representative Newman.
When I look at the word with intent to disrupt, what that to me is a fact issue, which if someone is charged with a crime under the statute, a jury would decide whether or not there was an intent, whether it was a button or a sign, or what was the language on the button or on the sign. So ultimately, I think that this is a fact issue, which is true in every criminal statute that we pass. Intent is one of the essential elements of a crime. So I don't think if we debated this issue all day, we will ever get to that bright line that you're looking for, Representative Paymar, because I don't think it's there. Ultimately, it's a fact issue for a jury.
Representative Paymar?
I interrupted staff, and I'd like her to finish whatever she was going to say.
Hey, Ms. Perez?
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, I was just going to mention something that I put in my memo on page 2, and I was looking at the Ulmer case, and there the court struck down the rule because, or the ordinance, because the ordinance was not tailored to prohibit activity that disrupted a service or prevented access to a service, and that's what the amendment was trying to get at.
Representative Hamer?
That's on page 2.
Page 2, fourth paragraph down.
No question, no question. Okay, then we have Representative Meslow had a comment or question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I watched the tape and as I listened to the testimony, one of the things that struck me, Mrs. Carlson, was not only the great dignity with which you have conducted yourself, but the great restraint that you showed in the face of the things that were going on. That is also, and in fact, in my mind, one of the primary reasons why this is a necessary law for us to go forward is that not everyone would be capable of the great restraint that you showed, and you are to be commended for that. But it is understandable that with the level of protests and counter-protests that could be engaged in this type of behavior, that it could incite violence. And that's what greatly concerns me in this situation, and it is well within our authority to pass laws that affect speech in order to prevent the outbreak of violence. That's why I believe this is a very necessary and very appropriate statute. Representative Smith, I do have an amendment that I would like to propose, and the reason that I'm thinking about that is that we've heard that there are other states that are passing similar statutes. We're hearing that some of these same protesters are traveling around the country. And so what I'm wondering is whether you would take it as a friendly amendment if on the A1 amendment, line 118, after the reference, when we're talking about a gross misdemeanor, when you say whoever is convicted of a second or subsequent violation of paragraph A, if we could then insert the language or a statute from another state in conformity with this statute, and then continue with the language is guilty of a gross misdemeanor, so that if an offender had broken the law in Wisconsin and then came to Minnesota and engaged in a protest and broke this law after having been convicted elsewhere, that this new charge could be a gross misdemeanor. I'm wondering if you would take that as a friendly amendment, Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Meslow, I see where you're getting at. I'm inclined to agree with that, unless it engenders majority opposition from our committee. So, Mr. Chairman, I will listen to advice from the committee.
Okay, Representative, was it to this point?
To this point,
Representative Ellison?
You know, in terms of advice, Mr. Representative Smith, I would recommend that you do adopt it, and I would just point out that if you get a DUI in another state and then you come to Minnesota and get one, that DUI can be used to enhance your sentence. So there is precedent for it in other areas of the criminal law. I don't think that it's out of bounds or far out or anything. We're already doing it in other areas. I think it's a good idea.
Representative Meslow?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, it's ironic that you brought that up because, in fact, that was the very statute I looked at when I crafted this language, and I would agree with you.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure the method you want to use. I'm willing to accept it as a friendly amendment if we can just so incorporate it without any objection.
Okay, does anybody have the amendment? Could we read it exactly as it was given, and then we can...
Mr. Chair, the way that I worded it is on line 118 of the A1 amendment, following the parenthetical A, to insert the language, or a statute from another state in conformity with this statute.
Okay, any other questions or comments on that amendment? So Representative Meslow moves to amend the amendment, or amend the bill at this point. All in favor of that, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Okay, Chairman, at this time, I would like one other piece of information. to be made part of the record, and for that I'm going to ask Mr. Carger to inform us that since this bill does reference a misdemeanor or gross, the potential of a fiscal note, if the chair would recognize Mr. Carger to address that, I would appreciate it.
Okay, Mr. Carger, do you have information about the fiscal costs?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I contacted all the agencies that would probably be involved in the fiscal note, and they said they would probably show a minimal impact, which would mean a zero on the fiscal note.
Mr. Chairman, if there's nothing further, I'd like to proceed with the motion.
Okay, I think before we do that, could we just, is there anyone in the audience that would like to speak for or against the bill? We'd like to make it very quick, but if somebody came here and would really like to make a statement, I guess we'd open that up at this time just for a moment.
You got to vote on the amendment, or did you just
accept it? We did vote on the amendment.
Some bill.
So seeing no one else that wishes to testify, Mr. Representative Smith, do you want to renew your motion?
Mr. Chairman, considering what we've done here today, I'm going to restate my motion, and that this bill, as amended, be recommended to pass and that be referred to the consent calendar in the House.
Okay, Representative Smith. Representative Paymer,
I just have a comment.
Okay, one more comment. Okay, Representative Paymer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Smith and Ms. Carlson. I think all of our hearts go out to you and the bravery of your son and his death for our country in war. I have to say I came to the committee today with mixed feelings about the bill, and I think all of us search our minds about the First Amendment rights of people that people like your son fought for and died for, versus the civility that I think all of us expect at a funeral. I think of my mother passed away last year, and I can't imagine what I would have felt like if someone protested at her funeral. And she died in a very different way. So I understand that. But I have to say, I think we are walking a fine line here today, and I'm going to vote for the bill at committee. Think about it when it gets to the House floor. I've always been one that believed in even the most heinous kinds of free speech that we should allow it. I remember struggling over this issue when the neo-Nazis, were protesting in Skokie, in neighborhoods where there were many, many survivors of the Holocaust. And I thought, how can that happen? How can people do that? But I still thought we, as a country, should allow them to do it. And that it sort of points to the ludicrous the behavior was. It's better to let them demonstrate and to show the foolishness of their behavior and their actions. And in some ways, I feel the same way about Mr. Phelps. And on the other hand, I have to put myself in your shoes, in my shoes, or any other family's shoes who have lost a son or a daughter in a war, or lost a loved one, period. So I don't know if other members of this committee have searched their minds over the constitutional issues here, but I have. And then finally, I'm going to say something, too, that I do think, but I see Representative Severson is sitting there, who's one of the authors of the bill. I do believe in my heart that bills like the marriage amendment that Representative Severson is the chief author of and that many people support, in many ways, provide the climate for this kind of behavior and perpetuates this kind of behavior in the minds of some. And I think the legislature needs to look long and hard at its own behavior and what it's doing. If you look at some of the signs that were on the protesters had right in front of the Capitol here, they were just as horrible as the ones that were at your son's funeral. So I support the bill today, and think about it when it gets to the House floor. I do have concerns that we're walking that fine line. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, the motion before us is that House File 2985 be recommended to pass.
Chair, before you proceed, I just want to modify want to be, I want to explain to the committee, I modified my motion that it go to the consent calendar, because typically, and we amended the bill today to move the date from August 1 of 06, which is typical in all other bills, to be amended to read upon enactment. I'm now asking the committee to move this bill to the consent calendar, and it's going to be my intent to ask the speaker, should this bill be moved to the consent calendar, that he bring it up next week, Wednesday, or as soon thereafter as we meet in session, and I would urge the Senate and the governor to act. I would like to see this bill become the law of this state within the next week. So I'm seeking now to move this bill along quickly. And I then, therefore, renew my motion that the recommended to pass and be referred to the consent calendar.
Okay, any questions on the motion? House File 2985 be recommended to pass and refer to the consent calendar. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the bill is passed and will be moved to the consent calendar. Thank you, Ms. Carlson, and Representative Smith. The next bill we'll be taking up will be House File 2846, Johnson on the eminent domain issue. Representative Johnson, if we're ready to proceed at this end, I trust you are down there.
I am.
Do we have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move that House File 2846 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Local Government.
Representative Johnson, tell us about your bill, and then we do have a number of witnesses, so I would like to see what we can do to structure some time here. I count roughly 15 or 16 witnesses after you, and while we fully intend to sit here until we have heard fairly what everyone wants to say, we prefer not to sit here until the cows come home, so we would like to look at roughly 3 or 4 minutes for I almost heard that. What I'm trying to say is we're going to have a good full fair hearing, but we need to be brief. Everyone who's going to testify, let's keep that in mind. Representative Johnson, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me, Representative Ellison.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. How are we going to handle amendments today? There are a number of them.
Good question. Representative Ellison, I believe the chair would like to hear the presentation of the bill and the testifiers and then go to amendments. And then at that point, it will be at the committee's at the table, so we will not have any further testimony. We will deal with the amendments at that time. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is the eminent one of the eminent domain bills in the legislature right now, and we have been working for many months on this issue. There actually have been some who have been working on pieces of this bill for years, and I can tell you that when I first introduced a bill on this, which was shortly after Chairman Smith introduced a bill on this last special session, it was one or two sentences long. That bill has changed dramatically over the course of the last 8, 9, 10 months, and it's changed dramatically based upon input from people who had concerns about the bill. We've gone from a few sentence long bill to a 15-page bill to a 6-page bill. It's changed a lot, and it's changed in ways that I think should be positive for the folks who are worried about restricting eminent domain use too much. There are days after making many, many changes that I am tempted to offer an author's amendment to go back to my original two-sentence bill and just say, let's say, no eminent domain for economic development, period. I know there's quite a few people in the legislature who would like to see that. Then work from there to find middle ground by the end of session, because I think that's where we are right now. I think we're at the middle ground. I think this is a very reasonable bill, despite what some people will claim today. I'm not going to do that, however, and we will continue to work on this bill and try to address what are some legitimate concerns over the course of at least 4 more committee stops and conceivably more than that. The basic 2 principles in this bill, despite all the changes in details, the basic 2 principles have remained the same, and that is that when the principle number 1 is when government is going to take property for the purpose of economic development, so take from one private entity to give or transfer to another private entity, it ought to be very difficult. Not impossible, but very difficult to do that. And it only ought to happen in those cases where there is something significantly wrong with the private property that is being taken to transfer to another private person or entity. And the other principle is when government wants to take property through eminent domain or needs to for a truly traditional public use, like a school or a road or a government building or a park, we don't want to stand in the way of that because that's an important tool, but we do want to make sure that there is a fair procedure and that just compensation is provided to the victim, if you will, of the taking. So with respect to the details, the bill has changed, but those principles have stayed the same, and I am very willing to talk more, and we will make more changes, I have no doubt, to the details, but I do want those principles to remain. And let me just say one more thing before I very briefly walk through the bill. What we heard in the last committee meeting were a lot of comments and stories and pictures where they said, look at what this property looked like before, and look at what we ended up with. Think about the financial benefit to the city. Or think about the jobs that we created. Or look at how much nicer this looks. That's not the question. That is not the question that we need to answer. The question isn't, doesn't it look nicer? Or aren't we making more money? Or weren't more jobs created? The question is, are we willing to sacrifice one of the most fundamental rights of our neighbors so that we can have a nicer place to shop? Or are we willing to take away the land of our neighbors so that we can live on it or shop on it or build condos on it? It is not so simple as does it look nicer or does it bring in more money. It's a very, very fundamental constitutional right we're talking about. So please keep that in mind. Let me just very briefly walk through the bill. Section number 1 is just a preemption provision that provides that the language in this bill prevails with respect to eminent domain takings throughout the law and statutes of Minnesota. There's a lengthy definition section, and let me point out the 2 or 3 pieces that are most important. If you go to page 3, kind of the heart of this whole bill is subdivision 11, line 3.11, and that is the definition of public use. The Constitution tells us that you cannot take through eminent domain except for a public use. And some courts have expanded that to a public purpose. So we've defined that specifically here. Definition number 1 is our traditional definition of public use, a school, a road, a government building. Definition number 2, the creation or functioning of a public service corporation, which is later defined, would include such things as electric utilities, railroads, and airports. And then piece number three is the big exception to the economic development rule. And this says that you can take from one private entity and transfer or give to another private entity for economic development through eminent domain for one of four reasons. Mitigation of a blighted area, which is defined. Remediation of an environmentally contaminated area, which is also defined. Reduction of abandoned property or removal of a public nuisance. And let me just tell you where each of those belong in this bill. Start at the end. Removal of a public nuisance simply is, as it's defined in law, a threat to the general public's safety or health. So a meth house or a crack house would be a great example of a public nuisance. Abandoned property means property that the government can't find the owner. So you can take that property and transfer it to another private owner for economic development. Environmentally contaminated area is defined on line 2.27 and following, and I will tell you, based upon testimony in the last committee, I am not comfortable with the language in here. And we are working right now with several different folks, including our second author, Representative Thiessen, on finding language that creates a better exception for environmental contamination. I would prefer not to play around with that today because I think we can come to some language before the next committee on that. And then the big one, mitigation of a blighted area. And this is the reason for eminent domain takings that is often used by government, especially city government. And we have a definition of blight starting on line 2.14 on the second page. Blighted area means, exclusively at the time of condemnation, an area that is zoned and used for urban use and where more than 50% of the buildings are dilapidated. And dilapidated is then defined in the following subdivision. And essentially what it says is there must be a code violation that's been in place for a year. The building owner is unwilling to fix the code violation. And that at the date of condemnation, the building that is considered dilapidated is unfit for human use because it is unsafe, structurally unsound, or lacking in basic equipment. That is a high standard. It's a very high standard. It's not an impossible standard, but it's a very high standard, and I think it should be because, again, we're weighing two interests here. The interest of the public good in the eyes of a government entity versus the right of someone to own their property without government taking it away from them. So I believe it should be a high standard. Section 3 on page 3 essentially provides that for if you're using the environmental contamination or the blighted area exception to the economic development rule, you can take pieces of property that aren't blighted or aren't environmentally contaminated as long as you can show that it's absolutely necessary to take them in order to remediate the blight or remove the dilapidated buildings. On the next page, there's an attorney's fee provision, which in a nutshell provides that if a property owner challenges a government taking and wins, either by showing that this isn't a public use or getting 20% more than the final written offer of the government, that property owner gets his or her attorney's fees covered by the government. Section 5 on line 4.12, with respect to takings for those four exceptions that I talked about, so for economic development purposes, the private-to-private takings, we have raised the standard. The standard is now that the government is going to have to show through clear and convincing evidence that this is an appropriate taking under the law, and that is a higher standard than what we have right now. There is a section C there under 4.22 requires for de novo review to the appellate courts. There was some very good testimony in the last committee on that, and I'm very open to talking more about whether we really need that piece or not. Line 4.25 is the provision regarding going concern, which says that if business property is taken, you have to look at more than just the value of the building and the land, but what the actual value of the business is and what value might be lost if that business is moved. On page 5, section 7, line 5.16, there is a provision that says that the damages payable to a victim of eminent domain at the minimum must be sufficient for the owner to purchase a similar house or building of equivalent size in the community and not less than the condemning authority's payment or deposit under an earlier section in the bill. There is a limitation that a government, below that in Section 8, that a government cannot require a property owner to take substitute property as opposed to being paid just compensation. I mentioned the public service corporation exception. And then the final provision is procedural, and it simply says that if a city is going to take property from eminent domain, they have to have a public hearing and a vote on that taking. Mr. Chairman, that is the bill in a nutshell.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Are there any questions from committee members of the author of the bill? If there aren't, we'll move to the testifiers. But first, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this might not be to the author, but maybe to staff. I'm curious as to if we could get exactly what the public nuisance section is and the definitions of what falls under that to frame our discussion.
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hillstrom, the public nuisance statute that the definition references is included in the bill summary. And on page 2 of the bill summary, it states that that nuisance section is whoever by an act or failure to perform a legal duty intentionally does any of the following is guilty of maintaining a public nuisance. Maintain, permit, condition, which unreasonably annoys, injures, endangers the safety, health, morals, comfort, repose of a considerable number of members of the public, interferes with, obstructs, renders dangerous for passage public or any public highway, right-of-way, or waters used by the public, or is guilty of any other act or omission declared by law to be a public nuisance for which no sentence is specifically provided.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Given that definition, Representative Johnson, could you tell me if a motel that rents rooms by the hour would meet that definition?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, I don't know, and that may end up being for a court to decide. I suppose you could argue that that unreasonably annoys the morals, comfort, or repose of any considerable number of members of the public. Certainly an argument could be made.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Paymark.
Mr. Chair, maybe this is a question for you. I don't mind hearing the bill, and I'm sure we'll be hearing this bill a lot about this bill, and many committees will hear it, but just wondering why it's here in this committee. I mean, do you want to hear it, obviously, but I'm just trying to find out, are there any criminal penalties here that are...
Representative Paymar, I think the primary reason is that, frankly, I think this committee in the House is best suited, more so than any other committee in the House, to review and discuss bills dealing with all aspects of the law, to build a really decent legislative record of intent of the author and any problems that may come up or amendments. So I think it was an overall approach. I wanted to give this bill airtime to give some of the best minds, some of the best legal minds in the House on both sides of the partisan fence an opportunity to look it over and have at it.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, can I add something to that?
Representative Johnson.
I think in particular, if you look at page 4, section 5, where we are talking about a change in the standard and especially the de novo review, that will certainly have an effect on the judiciary. So all of this may be relevant, but that in particular, I think, is to the committee.
Any other questions? Representative Newman. And then Eastland. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Johnson, in looking at some of the language in prior court orders involving this, the area of the ability of the court system to review the decision of a condemning authority, it strikes me is that the court system had almost no authority to overrule the decision of a condemning authority. I'm looking at some language that indicates that a city council's resolution that taking is a necessity to achieve a proper purpose is prima facie evidence of necessity, and authorities' determination of necessity can only be overturned if it's arbitrary and capricious. It seems like the courts were severely limited in being able to review the decision of a condemning authority. And I'm just looking for some assurance from you that this bill addresses that type of an issue so that the condemning authority, in fact can be reviewed. And if you could just address that, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Newman, you're correct. And the standard that I've most often seen in especially economic development takings is substantial deference to the governmental authority, which means you just got to give us a good reason that this taking is for a public use or a public purpose. What this bill will do is it will really shift that to say you got to show, at least in those private-to-private takings, clear and convincing evidence, which again is a high standard. I recognize that, but certainly it is a shifting of the burden, and it is going to require governments that want to use this power to present more than just a essentially straight-faced argument.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, in the dilapidated building case, the landowner gets 12 months to remedy. Is that kind of the deal, a year?
Representative Johnson.
That's correct.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, what about in the cases where there's a nuisance? Does the landowner get an opportunity to remedy before the authority could actually do the taking?
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Eastland, that is, no, there is no such provision in the bill.
Representative Eastland.
Okay, Mr. Chair. And then maybe this is related to Representative Newman's question, but in on line, 3.25, it says the... A taking can be done on a non-dilapidated building when it is absolutely necessary. What does that mean, and who makes that determination, and what is the criterion for that?
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Eastland, we talked about this a bit on Wednesday in civil law, and we are re-looking at that language to try to be a little more specific. But right now, at least in the my understanding is in the context of eminent domain takings, the term necessary all by itself has been given the meaning essentially of convenient, which is not good enough for this, in my opinion. And so we chose the term absolutely necessary to simply maybe raise it to the term of necessary as most of us would see it. But it's something that we're looking at because some folks say that we would like something more specific, and I think that's a fair question.
That's all. Representative Paymar.
Just a quick question, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, if you already covered this when you were going over definitions, I apologize, but under public nuisance, without me reading Chapter 609, in the city of St. Paul on University Avenue, I believe we used eminent domain to get rid of some pornography establishments that were deemed a nuisance by our community. Would that change at all with your bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymar, if they were deemed a nuisance by the courts under the nuisance statute, that would not change. That we're not changing the definition of a public nuisance at all.
Thank you.
Very good. Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, in response to Representative Paymar's question, as I understand the bill, it would change things for his neighborhood because in order to take that property that the community felt was a nuisance, they'd have to prove, and correct me where I'm wrong, that it is absolutely necessary by clear and convincing evidence to take it. Whereas now, they could take it without meeting those legal thresholds. Let me know if I'm right or wrong, because I want to be accurate.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, if we go to page 4, starting on line 4.17, here's where the increased standard comes in. And it says if the taking is for, and go down to removing a public nuisance. So if the taking is for removing a public nuisance, then notwithstanding any of the provision, a condemning authority must show by clear and convincing evidence to the district court that the taking is necessary and for the designated public use. So what government's going to have to show is by clear and convincing evidence that this actually is a public nuisance under the law. But if you can show that, you can show that. And then that it's necessary in order to remove the public nuisance, to remove that building. I don't think that would be all that difficult, frankly, as long as you can show by clear and convincing evidence that this is a public nuisance under the statute. We haven't changed the definition at all.
Representative Ellison.
And so you may not have to prove it's absolutely necessary, but you do have to show it at a higher threshold of proof than you do under current law. Isn't that right?
And Mr. Chairman,
Governor Johnson,
to actually do a taking, yes, that is correct.
And the legal threshold now would be essentially substantial deference, and we are going to go past the civil threshold of preponderance of the evidence all the way to what is essentially, you and I have talked about, a quasi-criminal standard of proof, which is clear and convincing evidence. Am I right about that?
Representative Johnson.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, I don't know that I'd call it quasi-criminal because it's used in several other civil areas in the state, as we discussed on Wednesday. But yes, the standard is being raised if you are going to take the public nuisance for purpose of transferring it to another private entity.
Mr.
Chair. Representative Ellison.
But you would agree that we are bypassing the civil standard that is applied in any contract, any tort, any civil case. We're bypassing it and going to a higher standard, which is generally used in the criminal context. I think you and I agree that clear and convincing is used in probation. If you want to revoke somebody from probation, clear and convincing evidence. If you want to commit somebody, that's a civil matter, but it involves a liberty interest, and that, you know, clear and convincing. You know, we are bypassing that civil standard that we normally apply. Isn't that true?
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, we are bypassing, we're going above and beyond the standard that we use in many civil cases when we're not talking about a constitutional right. Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison, do you have a follow-up?
I have a final follow-up, because I want to just bring it to a close and move on. You know, if we in the last bill we talked about, that would be a criminal bill, and you'd have to prove the guilt of the violator by proof beyond a reasonable doubt. But the fact is that if you were trying to prove a constitutional right, does not necessarily involve a higher standard of proof. Civil standards of proof are applied when constitutional rights are involved all the time. I offer that not as a question, because I know you're not going to give up, and neither am I. But the point is that I don't want to leave the impression that civil standards of proof are inapplicable merely because of the invocation of a constitutional right. So I leave that there, Jeff.
My only response is this is still a civil standard of proof. It's just sometimes used in the criminal context as well.
Thank you for adding that.
You're welcome.
As we go to Representative Hillstrom, was it not a good idea, Representative Paymar, that we are hearing this bill? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As a disclosure, I get to hear this bill again in local government, so I'll have limited questions today on this. But I do want to get to the crime piece because this is the Public Safety Committee. And we have some, in the past in my community, we had apartments where we had some pretty irresponsible landowners. They would get cited repeatedly for difficulties with their apartment buildings. And then as the city got ready to take them to court criminally, they would bring them up to code. And then the city would have to go in again and reinspect, only to find that not in the same unit, however, but maybe in other units, they had the same kinds of violations. And health and safety violations, of course, were occurring. We even had one landowner who, for example, every time an apartment unit became unlivable, he merely shut the door and locked it, kept it vacant, and then had people move to a different unit. When I was first elected to the city council, I remember going into those buildings, and you could stand in the basement floor, and you could see out. You could see the sunlight up through three apartments. They were so irresponsible in the way they dealt with that issue. So the problem is you don't always necessarily get to go in all the time and do every single unit-by-unit inspection. Cities don't have the resources to do that. So my question is, how would you apply this to something like that? So they had to have had more than one building code violation in the last 12 months. And then it also says at the bottom that they couldn't, in the next one, that they didn't bring it up to compliance. So if you didn't necessarily inspect every single unit every single time, you wouldn't necessarily know that it was deteriorating to that rate, which my community didn't. And so to get to the standard of unfit for human use, if no one is renting those units because they just merely shut the door, you aren't getting complaints on them, so you don't necessarily know about that. So how does this take care of that kind of issue? Because, again, they get a complaint, you write an order, and then they comply, and then you get another complaint, you write an order, and they comply. And so you never really get to the underlying issue. Is that taken care of somewhere else in this bill? Or?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Johnson.
Representative Hillstrom, if you don't fall under the definition of dilapidated building, which you might not if they continue to comply with the code, if they don't, by the way, that example might very well fall under it. If part of the building is uninhabitable, I think it may very well fall under this definition. But the public nuisance statute, again, if you read it, it's pretty broad. Maintains or permits a condition which unreasonably annoys, injures, or endangers the safety, health, morals, comfort, or repose of any considerable number of members of the public. So if, for example, you have a place that is crime-ridden and the owner of the property is unwilling to do anything about that, and they do the absolute minimum of coming up to code within a year when they know they have to, but continue to let this building serve as a drug house, essentially, that is kind of a traditional definition of public nuisance, at least in my mind.
Seeing no further questions, we're going to move to the testifiers. We have seven listed supporters of House File 2046. Mike Haking, National Federation of Independent Business. I believe you'll be introducing Matt Carpenter, so he should come forward as well. Am I correct?
Mr. Chairman, could I have Ms. Shalander speak first?
I jumped the gun. Go right ahead, Representative Jones. Gentlemen, have a seat. Sorry.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Alyssa Shalander, and I represent the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. The reason the auto dealers are involved in this issue, and we have been for the last several years, began when the city of Richfield condemned and bulldozed three of our auto dealerships on the corner of 494 and Penn Avenue in the city of Richfield. Since 2001, we've been at the legislature trying to urge reform of eminent domain laws, and I won't go into the gory details about the Walzer case because I'm sure you've all heard it. I guess the point is that, you know, we're not just being reactionists to the Kelo decision that was decided over the summer. We have been here. We've been urging this for several years and working on this. As you know, the Supreme Court this summer said that it was not a violation of the Constitution for government to take private property from one private party and convey it to another private party for the purpose of economic development. We were outraged by that because in Kelo, of course, there was no issue about whether those properties that were being taken were even blighted. In Minnesota, at least, where we are talking about removing properties that are to some extent blighted. However, I think the Kelo decision really just shone the spotlight on the state of the law and how vulnerable property owners are with respect to this issue. So since Kelo, we sort of looked at who was supporting the property owners in that case, and we started talking to people and getting them interested in what was going on here in Minnesota. And we've built a pretty large and diverse coalition of interested groups. We've got about 22 organizations that are in our coalition. The Minnesota Auto Dealers is leading the coalition, but we've also got the Farm Bureau, the Institute for Justice, which is just they're the law firm that represented the homeowners in the Kelo case in Connecticut, and they've been very helpful in helping us work through certain aspects of the law. The NAACP of Minneapolis and St. Paul were also amicus on the Kelo case and have agreed to support the legislation that we're working on here in Minnesota. Minneapolis Urban League, the Farmers Union, the Hmong Chamber of Commerce, the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, the Petroleum Marketers Association, National Federation of Independent Businesses, St. Paul Black Interdenominational Ministerial Alliance, the Minnesota Teamsters, Minnesota Alliance of Automotive Service Providers, the Outdoor Advertising Association, Hospitality Minnesota, the Minnesota Trucking Association, the Minnesota Family Council, the Minnesota Manufactured Housing Association, the State Cattlemen's Association, Association of Wheat Growers, the Highway Construction Council, and I think what's even more interesting is that we have got hundreds of individuals who have joined our coalition to support what we are trying to accomplish here in Minnesota. And really the reason that I think we have such a broad and diverse coalition is that everybody's got an example of how this has happened to one of their members. We've got members who have unique land uses, like auto dealers do, who have experience and who are afraid of continued Walzer-like takings. We've got farm groups who are concerned about preserving agricultural land, which is many times viewed as vacant land. We've got groups who are concerned that their members who are economically and politically disadvantaged will be negatively affected by this, as they have been in the past and will continue to be unless we do something to protect the rights of property owners. And we've also got a lot of small business groups who are really, they've historically been the target of these redevelopment efforts where governments are taking away small independent businesses in order to bring in big box retailers, national chains, and really high-end development. So that's really who we are and what we've been about for the last several months. I also want you to know that we are not trying to just jam this bill through the legislative process. We've got a lot of momentum and we've got a lot of support, but we are very interested in passing good law here, and we're working very closely with Senator Bach in the Senate, and Representative Thiessen, who was our author on this legislation last year, is second author on this bill. We're continuing to work through amendments with Representative Thiessen. We want to make sure that he is just as involved in the development of this bill and others as Representative Johnson has been. I just wanted to explain to you who we are and what we're up to. You know, Representative Johnson already went through the bill and sort of gave you an overview of what we're up to, but really, you know, it really boils down to just trying to put some fairness back in the process for property owners, because there's a real unbalanced playing field here. And I sort of always use the analogy of the Walzer dealership in Richfield, because there we had a very sophisticated landowner who buys and sells property all the time, had all the resources in the world to make sure he hired the best and brightest lawyers and professionals to make sure that his property rights were protected. Spent several years in litigation, paid a lot of money, millions of dollars, to sustain that litigation all the way to the Supreme Court, and still lost. And I just want you to think about that, because I think what's so instructive about that is the fact that there you've got someone who had every ability to make sure that his rights were protected in this kind of a taking, and still lost. So what happens when it truly is a mom and pop business, or really when it is a homeowner who can't write a check for $2 million to their lawyer to sustain a fight like that? You know, all we're really trying to say is it just needs to be fair. We're not trying to end economic development. We believe that economic development absolutely will still happen, and government will still retain the power of of using eminent domain. It just needs to happen more fairly, and the ends do not justify the means in many of these scenarios. So I'll be quiet. We have, if you wouldn't mind, Mr. Chair, I'd talk to Mr. Gilday about this beforehand. Mr. Howard Roston is here to testify on behalf of the bill, but needs to be in Dakota County at a little after noon. So if you wouldn't mind switching up the order a little bit and letting Mr. Roston testify. Now.
I'd be happy to.
Thank you.
He does very much so. He does. You do appear on our list. Mr. Roston, come forward, along with a number of others. In light of your need to be out of here, I'll be happy to take you now. I would like to start a three-minute rule on every testifier. We'll see what we can do to keep ourselves within that time constraint. Go ahead. Identify yourself, and then let's proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Howard Roston. Thank you for taking me out of order. I do appreciate it. I'm here to talk about what happens in the trenches from clients of mine who are engaged in eminent domain or condemnation actions at the hands of the government. And I'm here to tell you that the power is abused. And I've heard comments from many different people that, yes, there are small instances and isolated instances of abuse, but it's the exception to the rule. And that's just simply not true. I get calls all the time from people whose property is being taken for an office building or a Jamba Juice in the development, and they come to me and say, stop the government from taking my property. And the conversation I have to have with all of them is, you've got an almost insurmountable uphill battle. You're going to pay me a lot of money to do it. You're probably going to lose after you pay me a lot of money. And then to add salt to the wounds, the government, when you do lose and you go to argue about the value of your property, is going to tell you that we don't have to pay you for your business losses. We're going to pay you for the real estate, but to the extent that you've lost money in your small business, more often than not, we're not going to have to pay you for it because the law says we don't have to. So you have to pick up your business, move it, you have to switch your customer base, you have to switch the way you do things, and that's not on the public's nickel, that's just your problem. And this bill would address the public use provisions in the ways that has been outlined here today, and I'm not going to go through and talk about those again, recognizing the time restraints here. But it puts people in an impossible choice. Spend the money to fight for your business or roll over and leave because somebody has decided that in one of my clients' case, the tax business you have needs to go because the government wants to put in a small office building with a Jamba Juice and a Chipotle. Or in another case with other clients who are here, Leroy and Janice Hanisch, and I think you're going to hear from Leroy, you need to leave the house you built because a trucking company wants to put its corporate headquarters there. There is no doubt that there is good uses for the use of eminent domain and redevelopment, and this bill strikes the balance of permitting eminent domain for redevelopment in cases where there truly is a blighted area or in cases where there truly is a nuisance, but protects the small business owners like Mr. Mark Foreman, who I think you're going to hear from, and protects the homeowners like Mr. Leroy Hanisch from abuses of the government. So I'm here to support this bill on behalf of my clients, despite the fact, I might add, members of the committee, that if this bill passes, it's going to directly impact my practice, and it's going to hurt lawyers who practice in this area by taking away business. But despite that, I think it's the right thing to do for my clients, and it's the right thing to do for others who are impacted by this. I want to answer one question, if I may, about the standard of proof that's going around. What the government does in court is says, the city determined that this was a public use, judge, and you don't have the authority to second-guess the decision of the city. And in my case with Mr. Mark Foreman, you're going to hear about, the government there, City of Bloomington, was putting in a small office building, no evidence that it was going to increase the tax base, no low-income housing, no evidence it was going to increase jobs, and a purely private development for a for-profit developer. And what the judge said in his order is, I would really like to do something about this, and I'd be happy to distribute copies of the order, but I read the law on this, and I don't think I can. I think applying the law as it's situated requires me to grant this petition to condemn this small business despite the fact that I don't want to do so. So we can address that with this bill. We can make it fair for the landowners to protect their private property, and in instances where their property is going to be condemned, we can make sure that when the government does have the right to take it, they're compensated for their business losses as well, or what we call the loss of going concern. So thank you very much for your time, and I would urge you to support this bill.
Mr. Rustin, thank you. I'd ask Mr. Hickey to come forward. You're next. And if you're introducing someone, your companion can come along. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members. He's the National Federation of Independent Business, and appreciate the chance to take some brief comments today. We do have a real live small business owner here, and he would also like to talk about one aspect of the bill. Matt Carpenter is also a board member of ours. Really want to thank Representative Johnson for coming forward on this huge issue. This is our number one issue for the session, and small business owners are very concerned about losing clout as landowners and how we value landowners in this society. And it is our number one issue. We were very active in it in 2004, and we're one of the few groups to join with the auto dealers and actively lobby for changes in 2004. So we're also just not purely reacting to Kelo. But the Walter decision and the Kelo decision certainly set the stage for what people think is the devaluation of private property in this state and across this country. The fact that you own a successful small business, you built a home, you have a farm, you only own the property, doesn't seem to matter so much anymore. And we're very concerned about it. The centerpiece of the bill is obviously the provision trying to regulate taking for economic development reasons, and it's getting a lot of attention. Matt's going to talk about the other provision regarding attorney's fees and more, but just almost as important, appraisal fees, which doesn't get mentioned too much. But clearly, we're very concerned about people being wiped off the map economically for somebody's economic development plan when there's no blight, there's no contamination, and there's no dilapidation to that property. It's very concerning, and it's a critical provision, and we hope something significant passes this year. Second, the provision regarding attorney's fees and appraiser fees is critical. People a lot of times don't feel they have the economic wherewithal or it's worth it for them to spend a lot of money trying to defend themselves, and Matt has a good example of that, and he spent a lot of money trying to defend himself. And you may only get marginally more. You're up against a lot of clout and a lot of might of government, and people are going to get second mortgage, clean out their savings account, start liquidating investments to spend $40,000, $50,000 on appraisal and lawyer fees. It's pretty daunting for them. And finally, we're very supportive of the going concern provision, because even if you do, let's assume, get a fair settlement to the value of your building and the value of your land, you may get moved to a spot that's way less advantageous. Maybe you're on a highway, a major street, and you get dispersed to some other area where you lose almost all walk-in traffic. And that can really hurt a business, and the going concern tries to compensate them for the fair value of their total business, considering they've been moved from possibly a very advantageous situation. And I want to turn it over to Matt, and he wants to share a couple of experiences he's had with MnDOT.
Mr. Carpenter, state your name and then proceed.
Good morning. My name is Matt Carpenter. I live in Edenbury, Minnesota. Mr. Hickey asked me to come in to speak to you this morning about an example that I had in eminent domain with the Department of Transportation from Minnesota in the taking of two pieces of property that my father owned, Walt Carpenter, in 1998. They were adjacent to Highway 5, 212 in Eden Prairie. They were commercially guided, planned, very valuable pieces of real estate, extremely well located, about the best pieces of property you could imagine with great locations. And MnDOT was expanding Highway 212 and Highway 5 at that intersection and decided to take these two pieces of property. It was for a highway, so it was obviously for public use. And I wanted to share with you the experience that we had in the offers and what we ultimately accepted in the cost in doing this. So you get a real live example here. MnDOT offered my father $840,000 for this 3.17 acres, two pieces again. That was in, looks like about April of 98. He rejected that offer. He thought it was very low. And so we prepared for eminent domain hearing with the commissioners. It took until about September of 98 to do that. One of the interesting facts that happened was when we prepared, the MnDOT asked to provide the appraisal that they use or will use in that hearing, and their appraiser actually came in at $851,000, so it's about $11,000 more than they offered my father. Not a significant amount of money relative to the amount we were talking about, but it was more than they offered. We had about 3 days of hearings. We had attorneys involved, planners involved, a lot of our time involved to try to convince the commissioners that the value was significantly lower than what the just compensation should be for that property. The commissioner award was $1,230,850. That was 47% higher than what MnDOT offered. My father and I sat down. We said, you know, this is still low. This property is the best in Eden Prairie, in the commercial area, right on the freeway. We've done comparables for service stations and other types of things that would produce tremendous income, and it would be justifiable to sell the property at a much greater rate than that. But the question was whether or not he should take on the cost and the effort to go ahead and do it. And so his attorney negotiated with MnDOT and ultimately came to a settlement before appealing it to the district court. And that settlement was $1,423,728, 69% greater than the original offer. And I said to him, it's low. It's probably low by $4 or $5 a square foot, which would have been another $300,000 or $400,000 or $500,000 more. So I know that's a lot of money, but you're put in a very difficult position when you're going against MnDOT because they have all the resources and all the money. And my father had already spent over $48,000 to defend that position. And so the question was, well, are you going to spend another $50,000 or $100,000 to get more? It's possible you could get into court and people who don't quite understand maybe the value of this particular real estate against others would actually give you a lower amount. The risk reward was such that he decided to settle. So he spent about $48,000 to get that award. And I'm here to say that I don't think it was fair. He wasn't compensated to defend against that. And the law states that somebody who has their property taken should be paid justly for it. And if you get that kind of differential between the offer and the final settlement of 69%, that's not just, and that's not fair. And if it was just our case that was occurring like that, then you could say, well, it was an aberration, or, but it's not. And you're going to hear from, I'm sure, other people who have had tremendous fights and cost them a tremendous amount of money to defend their rights. So I would support this bill, and I particularly would support reimbursement for legal expenses, appraisal costs, planning fees for the property owners to defend their right to just compensation. I just had this last fourth quarter of 2005, an eminent domain hearing in Wisconsin, and I believe their law says that if the condemning authority comes in and the last offer that they make to the property owner is a differential of 15% compared to what the court or the commissioners offer, then the state or the condemning authority has to pay the property owner's legal fees. And that's the only way that you can hold the condemning authority to reasonably compensating the property owners. You got to put some teeth in the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carpenter. Our next witness will be Leroy Honest, St. Cloud Property. State your name and then go ahead.
My name is Leroy Hanisch, and I live in St. Cloud, Minnesota. A few years back, I'll tell you what happened to me, and this is happening to a lot of people around. Somehow you guys got to change the way this system works. This doesn't work. I spent an awful lot of my retirement money to keep my property and keep my business at the location it is, only because the big Trucking Storm decided they wanted to build their corporate offices there. They, being a real large company, went to the city of St. Cloud and said, hey, we're going to move to a different state. If you don't give us, give us, give us. They brought them out to my place, and they own the industrial park out there. And they said, well, we like the industrial park out here, but we're going to be right on I-94. What can you do to get us that property right there on 94? So he said, oh, yeah, if you'll stay, we'll give it to you. We'll get it for you. So they did. I watched this happen to a little old man that lived next door to me. They took 2 acres of his land right off the corner of an intersection, I-94 and Opportunity Drive. What they gave him for money, if I had done that to him, I'd be in jail for swindling money out of the old people. It's just unreal what they did. They then went to my aunt, who took 35 acres from her. 9 months later, they come to me and say, hey, we want your property too. But before the city does it, the corporation comes to me, or the company, and says, hey, we'd like to buy your place. And they give me an offer. And I says, I can't rebuild my home and my business for that. I mean, that's not just. And like having a gun to the back of my head, he says to me across this large table and says, if you don't take our offer that we're offering, we think it's fair. We're going to give it to the HRA, and the HRA is going to condemn it and give it to us anyhow for less money than what we're offering you. And I said, we don't live in Russia. You can't do that. He looked across the table and says, oh, yeah, we can. Watch and see. And on we went. The city then calls us up about 2 months later. The HRA invites us into the office. Says, come on in. You need to talk to us. I says, for what? Well, we're going to eminent domain your property. I says, what? I didn't think they were going to do it. What do you mean? Well, we need to talk. So we get there and talk. First thing they do is throw in front of me. And I says, you have 90 days to get your 5 kids, your business, out of there. We're doing a 90-day quick take. And I'm like, 90 days? I mean, you couldn't be kicked out of your house for not paying your utility bill or shut your gas off or in 90 days. But yet the city of St. Cloud and the HRA, who I don't even vote for the HRA, I mean, it's not an elected official, tell me that I have to get out of my house in 90 days. And my wife starts bawling at the table, of course, you know, and I'm going, well, where am I going to go in the middle of February? And I've got my house and my business, and how can I make this work? And I said, I don't agree with this. What do I do if I don't agree? The guy looks at me and says, well, you have to go to the public hearing. I said, what public hearing? Well, that'll be Monday night. I said, today's Thursday. I mean, in 3 days, I got to find legal counsel and decide if I should even fight this? He says, well, yeah, if you don't agree with it, you better come to the public hearing. So I called Walter Ford and asked him who their attorney was and talked to them. I got a good attorney and told me pretty much the same thing as those saying. You know, it's a lot of money. Is it worth fighting? Should you fight this thing for what you're going to gain? At the end, they're probably going to take it in. Your odds of winning are very slim. The system is broken because to win, to beat these big corporations and beat this city was real nil. And I looked at it and said, you know what, I can't look myself in 15 or 20 years in the mirror and say, hey, you know, I didn't fight for something that I really think is wrong. Because this was just wrong to what they were doing. I mean, I watched that old man just get raped on his 2 acres of land, and then my aunt get robbed from her land, and I was next to my neighbor who wasn't going to fight, sold out to a corporation directly, and then they wanted me next. And I just, you got to stop at someplace here. I mean, that's why I'm taking off the time I'm taking off to do this. I spent $80,000 fighting this thing. I mean, I luckily could take my retirement account and do this. Most people end up in the same boat like my neighbor there, the old guy. He looked at it and says, what should I do? Well, the city comes in with 2 attorneys, and he doesn't understand the whole system. And I said, no, you don't have a choice here. We're eminent domaining the property. We're going to take it from you, and we will just compensate you for it. We're going to give you a real fair value for it. But, yeah, he doesn't know what the value of this property really is worth. Like I said, it's a bad system the way it's done. I hope you change this. I hope you all look at this and go, hey, this will be my house next. This will be my business next. I can tell you stories endless on this here, how it went down. But luckily I had a good judge and a good attorney, and I won my case, and I'm still there today. It's a really bad deal.
Mr. Harmers, thank you. Anything else? Any questions? If not, thank you very much for coming today. Mr. Mark Foreman, Bloomington Property Owner, you are next.
Chairman, members of the committee.
State your name for the audio record.
My name is Mark Foreman. My wife, Gail. We've lived in Bloomington for the last 17 years, and we've, at least until recently, owned a commercial building a couple blocks from there at the intersection of France and Old Choctaw Road in Bloomington. We bought that building about 12 years ago after it sat empty for a couple of years because we needed a place to house our accounting office, and we chose this particular property because it was available and it was close to our house, walking distance, actually a couple blocks away, and seemed like no one wanted to really take a chance on it, but we did. That great financial risk, you know. We didn't know for sure if we were going to be able to rent out the extra space. We didn't, you know, we used some of the space in the building, but we needed to rent out the rest of the space to make it economically viable. But it did, and it worked. And it was close to the house. It enabled Gail and I to enjoy, me working close by, so we could help. You know, I could help raise our kids. I was just a couple minutes away, and so for 12 years we enjoyed the fruits of our labor, so to speak, of owning and operating this commercial building. Well, to make a long story short, the HRA City of Bloomington came in and condemned the property. We fought to protect the property, but we lost, and Now they have it. And one of the arguments that in our particular case, actually it was a blight case. They said that the gas station that was next to us was blighted, and it had sat empty for a few years. But they said that acquiring our property was necessary in order to make it, they had to assemble more than one parcel in order to make it a viable site. And so we, and the court records will show that we had architects come in and planners and things like that. It says, no, you could do it this way, you could do it that way. You can make Mr. Foreman's property part of the development by doing it this way, make it aesthetically pleasing to the overall development. And still, that wasn't enough. It's still... they allowed it to condemn the property, and we think it's wrong. So that's all I have to say. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Very good. Any questions? If not, thank you both for coming.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, can I just add something very quickly to that?
Yes, you may.
I've got the case right here in front of me, an opinion, and I won't read the whole thing, but there's a piece of it where the court determines that there's nothing wrong with this property whatsoever. But they finish up by saying, unfortunately, the court is compelled to conclude that existing precedent so tightly circumscribes the court's review that, in essence, its hands are tied. That's what we're trying to change.
Mayor Diana Longray, City of Maplewood.
Thank you. My name's Diana Longry, and I live at 1771 Burr Street in Maplewood, Minnesota. I'm an attorney. I have my own solo practice, and in addition to being the mayor of Maplewood, I am the chairperson of the general practice section of the Minnesota State Bar Association. I'll be brief. I just have three things that I wish to address, and first I want to say that I support this bill. I feel that we need to get back to the basics and to a common sense definition of the word blight that's measurable and objective, that's based on building safety, something that people can look at, that they can quantify. It's an open secret that in first ring suburbs like Maplewood, redevelopers hover and they circle shopping for city administrators and city councils that are vulnerable to the jazzed up sales pitch of instant prosperity, ready to find blight or to create blight by looking at those areas that they say are quote unquote tired,
that needs sprucing up when there are plenty of other resources out there to help these parts of our community, to help spruce them up. This disproportionately impacts and affects our town senior citizens and our small businesses. When I'm looking at the provisions of the bill, I want you to consider looking at, when you're thinking about that burden of proof, thinking about what is the underlying intention of the governmental body when they're looking at using eminent domain. Is it one, is it that underlying intention of a public use is the primary purpose? That primary purpose of putting in a road and putting utility lines, those kinds of things? Well, I think we all agree that we need to have eminent domain as a tool for those types of public purposes. Or is the underlying intention something different in looking at mitigating a blighted area, in remediation, in reducing abandoned property? If that's the underlying principle, if that's the underlying intention, and using eminent domain and finding a public purpose to relieve those kinds of issues, then I think the burden of proof needs to be changed. And the reason I say that is that all of my clients are little Joe Q public people, and they really don't have the resources to be able to defend when this comes before them. And also in looking at going concern, I ask you to consider how this idea of going concern conceivably could apply to those people whose business is rental property, whether or not if it's commercial or it's residential. Sometimes rental property, of course, is their livelihood. That is their business. And many times location is very key to that very business that is theirs, which is rental. And so in closing, I just want to mention that, in my opinion, this is a matter of fairness, but more than that, it's a matter of preserving a constitutional right that each of us have. And I believe that the Kelo decision was wrong. And I urge you to consider what provisions that you would want to have in a law that is in place to preserve your constitutional right if you were the subject of an eminent domain taking. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor. Mm-hmm. Any questions of the witness? Yes, we do. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I stepped out for a minute.
No problem.
I'm apologizing. So are you here representing the city of Maplewood?
No, I'm here in my capacity.
You have to wait until a question's asked, and then I'll recognize you just for purposes of the audio record so we know who's talking.
Sorry.
Representative Hillstrom, were you done?
Mr. Chairman, I just was attempting to get a sense of whether she was here representing the city of Maplewood as the mayor and it's their perspective, or if this was hers as a private citizen, or in what capacity.
Mayor Longley, now you can talk.
Thank you very much. That's a great question. I'm here primarily as a citizen, as an attorney, but we have not addressed this issue as a council. I do know that a number of my council members do support this bill. But we have not discussed it as a body.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison.
Representative Smith, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mayor, thank you for coming in and sharing your thoughts. I'd like to turn your attention to that section of the bill that defines blight and then lists dilapidated and environmentally contaminated.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any parts of your city that have either brownfields or contaminated sites which really can't get redeveloped because it would cost too much to fix them up?
Mayor Longley.
You know, that's a good question. There are a couple of areas within Maplewood that have been described as contaminated or brownfields. But to tell you the truth, I've actually never seen the Phase 1 studies that have been cited as having been completed. And what I've heard from one of the particular, with regard to one of the particular sites, that the level of contamination simply was chunks of concrete and asphalt, and that it was actually did not probably rise to the level of being the typical brownfield.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison.
What about this other part of the blight definition? Do you have any parts of your of Maplewood that have 50% of the houses are dilapidated, meaning that they're unfit for human use? Is that a problem that you experience in your city where you have sections of town where there's a bunch of houses that are dilapidated, meaning they're unfit for human use? Is that a problem you all are having out there?
Sorry, Mayor Longry.
Thank you for that question. And that is actually one of the reasons why I am concerned about the definition of blight and having it be something that's measurable. Because there are some older neighborhoods of Maplewood where people live and have their businesses every single day. But the word is starting to be thrown about that these areas are blighted. Whereas what I see is not blighted areas. I see areas that perhaps need a little financial help, or that we have other kinds of programs available within Maplewood where they could actually qualify for low interest loans to be able to do renovation so that they can stay within their neighborhoods, so that the business can continue to serve the people who live there, so that our communities are not displaced for some other bright, shiny, new, prosperous dream of somebody else's.
Last point, Mr.
Representative Ellison.
Well, Mayor, thank you for sharing with me that information. Let me assure you this. There are sections of our state of Minnesota, particularly my area in North Minneapolis, where we actually have houses that are truly dilapidated.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's great that this bill will give us a definition of what that really is. But the point is, if you have a neighborhood, if you have to prove that half of the houses are unfit for human use, if you have a neighborhood like that, wouldn't you agree that that neighborhood is in big trouble way before it gets to 50%? A neighborhood that has 50% dilapidated houses, meaning human beings can't use them. The fact is that neighborhood doesn't just have dilapidated houses. It has people who might live in the area. That might be an area that attracts drug dealers. That might be an area that attracts crack houses, prostitution, anything bad you can think of. And don't you think that the people, not the individual in every case, but the people of that neighborhood probably ought to be able to get some change in that neighborhood, even if it includes government taking well before we get to the 50% number of houses that are unfit for human use. Any thoughts on that subject?
Mayor Longry.
Well, I guess my opinion is that if a community or a city has that problem and it has gone on so long that they weren't perhaps using other tools that they could have used prior to having to resort to eminent domain, and that I certainly would think that in a community like Maplewood that our number one thing that we can do for our community is to be in touch with our citizens and our neighborhoods and understand those issues way before it ever gets to the point that 50% of the houses are not inhabitable. And I think that we have other avenues within our laws that we can use as governmental agencies to have compliance with the laws that are already on the books rather than letting code compliance slide, because code compliance is a very big issue in Maplewood. And that is one of the number one things that I get emails about is so-and-so is not complying with the code. And that is something that we take very seriously in Maplewood, simply for that reason, is that if you don't enforce your codes, if you don't enforce compliance with those, you have a loss of pride in your community, and it's a slippery slope to going to having problems with your property.
Mayor Longley, thank you. Representative Hilston.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually have a question for Representative Johnson, kind of along these same lines of questioning. In my community, we have something that's called the Scattered Site Acquisition Program. And what the community does is maybe a house has partially burned down. The bank has walked away from it. And the community comes in and they buy the property or they take the property. They rip down the house and then they put in a new house in place. Because usually there are things that people have, you know, either walked away from or maybe there was more money owed on the home than the person, you know, than the value. Does this bill do anything to change their ability to do that?
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilstrom, I don't think so. I mean, each case is going to be a little bit different, but certainly if there's a willing seller, that changes nothing. And I don't know if that's the case with respect to most of these situations, but this changes nothing with respect to being able to talk to somebody and convince them that they should buy it. That they should sell. If, however, you have a situation like Representative Ellison said, where you got a bunch of houses that are so bad that they're unfit for human use, you can certainly take every one of those houses under this bill. It's just you can't take everybody else's too, unless those houses rise to more than 50% of the property that you want.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Usually, when they're looking at taking one house, again in our scattered site acquisition program, it's because all the other houses are great and are fine, but for one reason or another, you either have, maybe a bank is not interested or not located in Minnesota or difficult to deal with or for some of those reasons. And I just want to make certain that as we move this forward and we're tightening up language on blight and those kinds of things, that we don't really do tie the hands of communities who are trying to do the responsible things in taking maybe one house here or one house there to save the entire neighborhood rather than allowing that one house or that one bank in another state to allow the entire neighborhood to deteriorate because there's maybe question about who owns the property or again, they're not here in Minnesota.
Okay. Any response, Representative
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilstrom, I'm not completely following, especially with the bank example. My guess is that bank would not fall under a bank that we just don't want there wouldn't probably fall under our definition. But do remember with, you know, houses that we think are run down, as an example, or, you know, there's been a partial fire or something. First of all, the government always can go in and convince the owner to willingly sell. Or if it rises to the level of being unfit for human use or a public nuisance, they can still use eminent domain. And as the mayor said, we're just talking about takings here. The government still has all its traditional police powers short of taking, such as fines, such as putting people in jail, such as regulation with respect to people who don't meet the code in the city. So this is just one of those tools, but this will make it, yes, more difficult if somebody doesn't want to sell their one piece of property, and the city just decides, well, we don't want this bank here because they don't bank in Minnesota. They're going to have to show that there's something more than just the city not wanting them there or convince the owner of that property to sell.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Wilson.
Just to clarify the bank, it's that the bank owns the home due to a default or something of the owner, and so it's difficult to locate who it even is sometimes to be talking to about the purchasing of the property on behalf of the city. So it isn't that there's a bank there or that the bank doesn't do business here. It's that it's some corporation who ended up with the property that, you know, poses some issues about the acquisition of the land.
Very good. Mayor Henry, thank you for your testimony. You can step away from the table. It would appear from the witnesses who have requested to testify will now move into what would be considered opposing testimony. I note that we have had 35 minutes on the side of proponents. We will limit the testimony now to no more than 35 minutes for the remaining scheduled testimony, that of the opposition. Having said that, it would appear that we have Pat Masha, Senior Vice President of Duke Realty, first. And is this also Kay Rockow? All right, two of you together, then Director of Public Policy, NAIOP. have seats.
Yes.
And be mindful of the remaining time. Thank you. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we really appreciate the opportunity to discuss this proposed eminent domain legislation this afternoon. My name is Kay Rocco, and I am here as the Director of Public Policy for the Minnesota Chapter of the National Association of Industrial and Office Properties. NIOP is a trade organization for the commercial real estate industry. We represent owners, we represent investors, and we also represent developers and various other professions in the commercial real estate industry. Our Minnesota chapter members own and manage about 160 million square feet of space, which houses about 8,500 businesses who employ about 300,000 people. As owners, investors, and developers of commercial real estate, we do not support many provisions of this bill as it is currently drafted. We are, however, in favor of reviewing existing eminent domain law and applying a number of principles that we have put together, which is on a brochure that you have in front of you. And we'd like to share some of these with you today. One of our board members, Pat Masha, is here, and he is prepared to discuss some of the specifics of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Masha. Go ahead. Give us your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Kay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pat Masha. As Kay mentioned, I'm a member of the Board of Directors of NIOP. I also run the Twin Cities operations of Duke Realty Corporation. We are the largest office and industrial real estate investment trust in the country, and we have a large local presence here. We own approximately 5 million square feet of commercial space in the Twin Cities, and we have land positions that support the development of an additional 5.5 million square feet of commercial space in the Twin Cities. As Kay mentioned, we are both an owner and a developer, and NIOP's membership is comprised of both owners and developers. And as owners and developers, we experience eminent domain from all sides. We've had land taken from us. We've worked on projects with municipalities that have used eminent domain to acquire roads and utilities and to correct blight and environmental contamination. Also, although it's not technically considered eminent domain, as developers, we are required, as a condition of having most of our developments approved, to give land that we own, that we've paid for, to the public for things such as parkland, roads, walkways, and ponds. Developers are not compensated for those exactions. I say this only to illustrate that eminent domain and dedications are a regular part of a developer's business. As Nat mentioned, after considering the experience of our membership, NIOP is against this bill. At the same time, we don't necessarily disagree with the testimony of the people who have testified before us. It's a matter of looking at it on a spectrum. We support improvements to eminent domain, but we believe that this bill goes too far. And the important thing is to make sure that people are fairly compensated and that the process works the way it's supposed to work. We have little time, so I will address a few specific instances in the bill and provisions of the bill and mention NIOP's positions with respect to those provisions. And these are contained in the guiding principles that we handed out before the committee hearing. First, the standard of review. We believe that any increase in the standard of review is unnecessary. As provided in principle number 2, any increase in the standard of review will effectively remove control of land use and land development decisions from the local authorities who should be making those decisions and encourage judicial activism. If we increase the standard of review, we risk turning our local city councils into mere conduits to the judicial system. I disagree with Mr. Austin. I believe that this law will only benefit the lawyers who try these cases, because these cases will be tried in the judiciary and not in front of local city councils. The definitions. We believe the definitions of blight and environmental contamination are too restrictive. According to Principles 6 and 10, these definitions will eliminate the flexibility that municipalities need to implement carefully considered and approved development or redevelopment plans within their jurisdiction. Eminent domain for economic development purposes. Again, the proposed legislation is too restrictive. According to Principle 6, we believe eminent domain in very limited circumstances is an appropriate economic development tool for municipalities to use. When used appropriately, eminent domain can prevent urban sprawl and correspondingly urban decay. Eminent domain can also help conquer blight environmental contamination, help cities reinvent themselves, expand tax base, and create jobs. In conclusion, eminent domain law can be improved, but we must sift through the emotions and consider all the facts and create reasonable solutions to any problems that actually exist. The fact is, Minnesota's eminent domain law has changed little in over 40 years. The Kelo case has come up in the testimony earlier. Kelo did not change Minnesota law. It merely affirmed what has been our law for a long time. We therefore ask that as you work on modifying a long-standing and settled body of law in Minnesota, to please ensure that the law provides for fair compensation and procedural due process. But we also ask that you do so surgically. Thank you. Are there any questions?
There are none. Thank you very much for your testimony. Next testifier is Bruce Messel, Moorhead City Manager and LMC Board Member. Come forward, state your name, and then go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Messelt, and I am serving as the Moorhead City Manager right now and also have the opportunity to serve as a member of the League of Minnesota Cities Board of Directors for the 870-some cities represented by the League. First of all, I just want to appreciate the fact that this committee and that the state of Minnesota has been open to the debate that goes on about eminent domain, and specifically I've also appreciated the fact that Representative Johnson has been willing to engage in discussions, including like he did by telephone conference with the Chamber of Commerce of Fargo-Moorhead, which represents our area. In addition, I would like to note that in general, there's a lot of agreement with Representative Johnson. Much work, in fact, has been done, and it would be sad to see that lost at this point. And generally speaking, many components of the bill are offered with start for this discussion. However, it is our opinion on the League that much more work needs to be done. What we are seeking from you is recognition that there needs to be a proportionate response to the legitimate problems and abuses that have occurred within the system, not a disproportionate overreaction to only the most egregious violations, some of which you may have heard of today from previous testimony. I would also note that many of those violations run contrary to the good and proper use of eminent domain and contrary to the historical realities that most, in fact, the vast majority of cities, in fact, face. As a result of that, I come for you on behalf of the League to raise our strong objections and concerns about House File 2846, the eminent domain proposal put before you today by the automobile dealers as well as by the Institute for Justice. The League believes that House File 2846 represents an extreme overreaction to the Kelo decision, and in fact the result of which would be to hamstring city efforts to address legitimate local priorities, such as eliminating the blighted conditions of our community, building affordable housing and particularly housing for seniors and an aging population, cleaning up polluted land, and, yes, boosting economic value in certain areas of the community. Like Moorhead, the great majority of Minnesota cities have not had to use eminent domain for any economic development purposes in the past several years. Most cities, in fact, don't ever use it or don't anticipate using it in the future. But there are those cities that have needed to use eminent domain primarily for redevelopment purposes, and this is a tool that we think must be retained, not merely in name only, as this would happen under Mr. Johnson's bill. A number of our cities, whether they're suburbs, core cities, regional centers like Moorhead, communities that are in your own districts, have found that sometimes, unfortunately, the only way to address legitimate local community concerns expressed by the citizens and the property owners through their elected officials about blight and contamination comes through, in fact, that judicious use or consideration of eminent domain. Cities like the one that I live in and work in Moorhead, have indeed in the past had to consider these uses of tools from time to time to revitalize their communities. I've handed out for you some photos, and I understand, we don't want to just do pretty photos, and I won't spend a lot of time on them. I just wanted to note four simple examples for you of what's happened in Moorhead. The first one I showed is called our Holiday Center, and this, in fact, was the last time the city of Moorhead used eminent domain. It was a vacant, dilapidated, obsolete office building. They had closed dry cleaners and restaurants, and only after the onset of the project, after eminent domain, did we find major environmental contamination. Now it houses our conference center, it houses a Marriott hotel, a new office building, restaurants and banks, and it will host future retail. There was no community opposition, but we did have one holdout property owner, and we're still in the court proceedings, very expensive to the community to resolve that. However, our concern is that under the new test of blight in this bill, this type of development would not be able to occur. The second page talks about another development that goes on in downtown Moorhead, which came because of the replacement of our Main Avenue Bridge. This was a MnDOT project, and it's unclear how the implications of this bill would affect this, because the property that was used was not used for public right-of-way, but in fact was used for staging of the construction activity. While eminent domain was not used, MnDOT did have to threaten it in order to make the project available. At a minimum, we know the project would cost more expensive because under this bill, it wouldn't have been able to occur on this property. The third page gives you an example of friendly condemnations. These are, in fact, small mom-and-pop property owners in Moorhead who asked us to condemn them. They did that because they wanted the tax breaks for reinvesting, and in one case, an elderly gentleman wanted to glamorously get out of his business. Now, while we never used eminent domain, it was that threatened letter, which you can use for tax purposes, which became a valuable commodity for our small businesses. And finally, on the fourth page, I would just note the last case, and this is after the bridge was completed. The picture on the right-hand side shows you the welcoming statement to Moorhead. Now, under the new test of blight, this would not qualify for eminent domain. And yet, we undertook a project where four of the five property owners voluntarily asked us to buy them out. We had one who considered holding out. We did publicly discuss at the council the use of eminent domain should it become necessary. Just that possibility led to a very reasonable and fair resolution, and in fact, the development that you see on the bottom is now underway. Clearly, I have to tell you that very few city officials, in fact, no city officials that I know of, want to use eminent domain. It is something we work very hard at avoid using, and we believe the cost of it is actually higher than settlement for those businesses that we are interested in discussing acquisition with. But when all other avenues are exhausted and a community-supported project is in jeopardy because of a single property owner who was holding out, these are not victims. These are, in fact, often the perpetrators of the problems. Eminent domain needs to remain a valuable tool for the community. The League feels that the current bill overreaches in many ways. Some of the most egregious problems include the following. Under the bill, cities could use eminent domain only to eliminate structures that are unfit for human use, something that is almost never seen in Minnesota. The standard for environmental contamination is totally impractical. The mere presence of contamination impairs the value of the property, and as in the case of Moorhead, the extent of environmental contamination is often not known until we actually undertake the work. The result is that most contaminated sites probably would never qualify under this bill. And finally, as you noted before, local legislative decisions will now be shifted to the courts. The bill will essentially give no weight to local elected officials, raising the standard of clear review. Protecting private property rights is of great importance, but what's being ignored is the right of the community to revitalize itself and enhance the quality of life of its residents and its businesses. As Representative Johnson heard when he discussed this issue with the Fargo-Moorhead Chamber of Commerce Public Affairs Committee, this is the result that they've authorized me to share with you. The committee comprised of business representatives and governmental entities from both North Dakota and Minnesota was very engaged in the discussion, asked many probing questions, and did not endorse or recommend any proposed legislative or constitutional changes at this time. Concerns were raised about the potential problems with taking away eminent domain tools when used when addressing legitimate issues of urban blight, vacant or abandoned lots or buildings, and larger community-sponsored redevelopment projects. Also of concern were efforts by state legislatures to weaken the autonomy and flexibility of locally elected and accountable municipal governments and school districts. Our chamber understands that this is often local property owners and local business people trying to figure out the best for their community. It's not necessarily big bad government versus the poor homeowner. Clearly, Minnesotans have the right to bring concerns to their cities about blighted properties in their neighborhoods and to expect that something will be done about it. They have the right to say that they don't want contaminated properties near their homes or near where their children play. And they also have the right to say that they don't want dilapidated businesses driving away the very customers that they see in their business district. As a result, the League would urge you to carefully consider the impacts of House File 2846 on the ability of communities to renew and revitalize, as well as to pass responsible reforms that balance the rights of individuals with the needs of the communities. We again laud Representative Johnson for taking the lead on this and look forward to continuing to work with him to make this a very good bill for all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Messel. Next, we have Mr. Tom Grunhofer, also League of Minnesota Cities, as General Counsel. Have a seat. Mr. Grunhofer, we've heard at length from someone already the League's position, so we don't really need to hear duplicative testimony. If you have anything new that you'd like to focus on, I'd ask that you do that. Go ahead and give us your name and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Grunhofer, General Counsel with the League of Minnesota Cities. We've heard a lot of talk about property rights, and obviously they're important. But there is another side of the equation, and that is the property rights of the citizens of the community. The property rights issue and the that issue is a very easy issue to talk about. It's the kind of issue that frankly lends itself to the kind of billboard campaigns that have occurred as a result of this issue. The problem is our side of the equation is much more difficult to explain and involves many more considerations than just property rights. It's talking about the interests of the citizens of the community. City economic development efforts and redevelopment efforts really do help promote housing, clean up pollution, increase public safety. They do some very good things. And I think it's short-sighted to look simply at the tool and not to take into consideration the effect the elimination of that tool will have on the ability of cities to revitalize themselves and to do the things that are necessary for the well-being of their citizens. One of the reasons in this state that we don't see the type of urban decay that occurs in other areas of this country is because our cities are fairly proactive in dealing with situations that constitute blight, in dealing with situations where there truly is contamination. Our cities are trying to do the things that are in best interest of their citizens, and quite frankly, this bill stops that activity. Redevelopment activity simply will not take place if this bill goes forward. And I say that for this reason. Individual property owners are going to be able to, in essence, veto redevelopment efforts that they can stand. If one property owner under this bill decides that they object to a particular redevelopment effort, they, in essence, have the ability to veto that redevelopment effort. I'm not sure that's the kind of public policy we want to encourage in this state or the kind of power that we want to put in the hands of one particular landowner. I do want to draw your attention to a piece in your packet that was put together by a group called the Fitch Financial Rating Agency. For those of you who have occasionally looked at municipal credit or state credit, there's three credit rating agencies in this country, Fitch, Standard & Poor's, and Moody. The piece in your packet makes some observations that Fitch has about the effects that restrictive eminent domain laws will have on credit ratings of our cities. Let me just quote from an excerpt of that. I think the Fitch piece, the highlighted language is in the material. We've underlined it. Fitch makes the observation that if eminent domain powers are restricted to a significant degree, Fitch rating believes municipal credit quality could be restrained or negatively affected. Fitch goes on to say, Fitch believes that restrictive legislation has the potential to contribute to a diminution of credit quality over a longer term, and that the proposed laws limit a state or local government's ability to respond to economic blight or weaken conditions. I'm not overstating the principle that this bill will shut down economic development and redevelopment efforts. It is that tight. The definitions of blight and environmental contamination are that tight. We simply don't have properties that typically rise to that level. If that is the intent of this bill, if that's the intent of the author, so be it. But I don't believe that's the kind of public policy we want to support in this state.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. The next is Corrine Thompson, Kennedy and Graven representative. Have a seat, give us your name, and proceed. Before you do that, just a note, we have a developing schedule for Wednesday. I just make a quick announcement to the committee members. It would appear that we're going to change our time of our Wednesday meeting to it being now 4:30 p.m. or 30 minutes after 4 session, whichever is later, and that'd be next Wednesday the 8th. So we're not going to meet in the morning. We're going to meet in the afternoon. This room, 200. All right, Ms. Thompson, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Corrine Thompson. I'm an attorney with Kennedy & Graven in Minneapolis, and I've been practicing in the area of eminent domain law for the past 20 years, primarily on behalf of cities and local entities, and primarily on traditional public use takings for roads, sewers, recreational trails, water towers, and public uses of that type. I want to speak to the committee today about three provisions in the bill that apply to all takings, including those traditional public use takings, the ones that I primarily am occupied with in my practice. The first is at Section 6 of the bill regarding the loss of going concern. This bill, and I'm referring to Subdivision 2 of the bill, creates a presumption in favor of the award of loss of going concern damages in every taking, including, and I think this would come up particularly in highway takings by MnDOT. It dramatically shifts the current burden of proof. Currently, a property owner who claims that they are suffering a loss of going concern is required to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that they have suffered those damages. This shifts the burden of proof over to the government, and not only does it shift it to the government, but it says you have to prove this negative, to prove that these people did not suffer a loss of going concern, and prove it by clear and convincing evidence. One of the problems with that is that in a claim of loss of going concern, the business and financial records of the business are under the control of the owner. And in a condemnation proceeding, until you get to the jury trial stage, at the commissioning stage, there is no discovery. So what this bill is saying is that there's a presumption that the government is going to pay loss of going concern damages. They have to disprove that those damages have been suffered, and they have to disprove it by clear and convincing evidence when they have no access to the real key evidence, which is the business and financial records of the owner in question. In Subdivision 3, it creates another procedural nightmare for the government because the owner can sit quietly while under the current law, MnDOT, for example, if it's doing a taking under 117.036 of the statutes, MnDOT has an obligation to meet and negotiate in good faith with property owners before it commences condemnation. But there is no corresponding obligation of a property owner to negotiate in good faith. This bill allows the property owner to sit silently by while MnDOT proceeds with its project, and then probably after the taking has already occurred, because MnDOT does many of its projects on a quick take basis, the property owner notifies MnDOT, oh, guess what, I have a loss of going concern claim, and you have 30 days, whether it's MnDOT or whether it's a local road authority, you have 30 days to find an expert witness, get ready for trial, have that person prepare their appraisal of damages without any evidence, by the way, and then disprove that these damages exist. Another problem with this provision is that it requires that the issue of loss of going concern be determined first by the commissioners. The current law, and the way the law has been for decades, is that the court must determine whether a taking has occurred. The court determines whether the going concern of a business has been taken, and commissioners are fact finders only to determine damages. This provision, by requiring that it go to the commissioners in the first instance for determination, intrudes upon that authority of the court. Now, with respect to attorney's fees at Section 4, Section 4 would require the court, mandate that the court order and award attorney's fees in any case where the final award or settlement is 20% over the last offer that was made by the condemning authority. I would urge this committee to amend this provision to make the award of attorney's fees discretionary. Anytime you have a mandatory award of fees, you are going to have game playing. And this is how this provision would be manipulated. With a mandatory award, remember, although the condemning authority has an obligation to negotiate in good faith, the property owner doesn't have that obligation. If I were the property owner's attorney, I would tell my client, don't negotiate. Don't let, you know, if the condemning authority comes forward and you think that it should be more money, don't negotiate. Wait. Let them file the condemnation because they're not going to bid against themselves. If you offer them something, you're simply increasing the amount by which you're going to have to prove that 20%. So don't talk to them. Let them file condemnation. And then after they file condemnation, I can bring in a loss of going concern claim maybe. Or I can bring in an appraiser who will testify to a substantially higher value. And I will be trying this case in front of commissioners, all of whom are familiar with condemnation law, and the fact finders will know that in order for you to receive your fees, you only have to hit that 20% mark. That is what a property owner attorney would do, I think, to protect the client, because after all, it's a win-win situation for the client. If they don't get the 20%, they're in no worse position than if they had settled with the condemning authority prior to the condemnation being filed. If they do hit that 20% mark, whether it's because they brought in a claim that they had never discussed with the condemning authority before, like loss of going concern, or because they simply had a very widespread in the appraiser's opinions of value, then the attorney wins, is going to get all the fees, the property owner wins, because the property owner will keep the full award rather than having to use that award to pay a portion of the attorney's fees. So,
Thompson, could you proceed to conclude, please?
Yes, I will. In my opinion, this provision on attorney's fees is going to encourage more litigation. It is not designed to bring parties together. And I have always told my clients the best decisions are the ones that are negotiated by the parties where they are both in control and where it's not handed over to a third party. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I now call Louis Jambois, A.M.M. Jambois, Executive Director, excuse me. Have a seat and pronounce your name correctly, and then go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Louis Smith.
good name, sir. Go ahead.
Thank you. No, it's Louis Jambois, and I'm with the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities. And prior to being with AMM, I've been there for 15 months. I was a director in the Business and Community Development division at the Department of Employment and Economic Development in its previous iterations. And what I'd like to do is speak from that experience today, if I may. And I want to focus on two issues. The first is blight, and the second is contamination. One of my responsibilities at DEED was to manage the Small Cities Community Development Block Grant Program, and I ran that program from 1986 through November of 2004. Through annual appropriations and special disaster recovery appropriations, we distributed close to $500 million to hundreds of Minnesota cities. That program has three national objectives. The first is benefit to low and moderate income households, and we used it for housing and infrastructure improvements in low income communities. The second was to eliminate an urgent community development need, and we used that objective to do disaster recovery in areas that were hit by catastrophic floods and tornadoes. The third was to prevent or eliminate slums and blight. The federal government required states and state staff to go through extensive training on the management of the Community Development Block Grant Program. So we went off to Washington and Chicago to learn about things, believe it or not, like blight. Simply put, blight in the federal vernacular includes several characteristics, including inadequate plumbing, heating, electrical systems, leaking roofs, bad foundations, inadequate or non-existent fire protection, and yes, dilapidation. The Johnson-Bach bill defines blight in really only two ways. One, it's an area in current urban use, and two, 50% of the buildings are dilapidated. Dilapidation in the bill goes on and is characterized, among other things, as a building that's unfit for human use because it's unsafe structurally or unsound or lacking in basic equipment. The difference between conventional use of blight definition and the Johnson-Bach definition may seem subtle in the confines of this room, but it's really dramatic in the field. I haven't seen in Minnesota a neighborhood or city where 50% of the buildings meet that definition. And I've been dealing with blight, again, from 1986 through 2004. And frankly, I hope I never do. I can't imagine why we as a state would want to create a public policy that allows deterioration to go that far before we do something about it. As a person who provided public money for redevelopment, I know that attacking problem areas early reduces the amount of public subsidy necessary to stimulate private investment. And put another way, what private investor wants to risk their money on reclaiming an area where 50% of the buildings are unfit for human occupancy, and how much public subsidy would it take to incent the private investors to come forward in that way? At a civil law hearing, Kendall Crosby, who is a St. Paul hardware store owner, told the committee he wasn't going to invest in his hardware business until a commitment was made by the city to clean up an area directly across the street. The Port Authority stepped in and cleaned up that area, and he reinvested. Now, he didn't get a subsidy to reinvest. What he saw was a commitment from the Port Authority and the city to clean up the area, so he made a commitment through that site, through his business on that site. On the contamination issue, issue in 1993, along with several others, some who are in this room, I helped draft a bill to create a contamination cleanup program. In 1995, the program received its first significant appropriation and was assigned to me at DEET. I hired staff and we were off and running. A few years later, the law was amended to provide funding for response action plans, which is an analytical tool that's designed to see how much contamination exists on the site and what an appropriate response, what an appropriate cleanup is on that site. Those plans can exceed six figures and often do. As of October 05, the program awarded $79 million in grants, so we did a lot of work with that program. At issue in the Johnson-Bach bill is the definition of an environmentally contaminated area. It says that contaminants on or below more than 50% of the surface area. Now, on a corner gas station site, we might be able to determine that contamination exceeds or meets that threshold. But on the 21-acre Max and Steel site across from Mr. Crosby's hardware store, 50% of the surface area is 457,380 square feet. In this bill, contamination, then, that covers 457,379 square feet is not sufficient contamination. Even a six-figure response action plan cannot measure contamination to that level or degree. And the Max and Steel site is not an unusual site. I'll wrap up in just about 2 seconds, Mr. Chair. More importantly, it's the cost.
On the count.
Okay. 1,002. Okay. More importantly, it's the cost of the cleanup that deters the redevelopment and not the surface area coverage of the contamination. Simply put, again, in addition to the acquisition costs, the infrastructure costs, and the capital costs to do a redevelopment, millions of dollars in cleanup costs impede the market from redeveloping an area. So it's not the percentage of coverage that's the issue, it's the cost. Obviously, I'm not with DEET anymore. I'm a lobbyist representing a municipal point of view, and as a result, I'm automatically suspect, and I understand that. So what I would encourage you to do is share what I have just shared with you with my former colleagues at DEED, with my friends at the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, and with the Voluntary Investigation and Cleanup Unit at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and ask them if what I've said is correct. I very much appreciate the time today, and I appreciate the author's patience with us on this. We want to work with him and with others to make a bill workable. That's our primary concern. Thank you very much.
Any questions for Mr. Smith? Mr. Jamboy, yes. Representative Ellison, then on the other side of the corner. Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Jamboy, if you, if a taking entity had to prove by clear and convincing evidence that a taking of an environmentally contaminated area was absolutely necessary, how many cleanups could we do through the use of eminent domain?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, I think we would have, between clear and convincing evidence and the definition of contaminated area, I think we would have an extremely difficult time taking even one. And the one we might be able to take would be a very small area where we might actually be able to measure 50% coverage.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Ellison,
if you couldn't take these areas and private developers don't have the wherewithal or don't have the profit incentive to clean them up, what would happen to these contaminated areas?
Well, the areas are the reason, Mr. Chair, Chair and Representative Ellison, the reason the contamination cleanup program was created in the first place is the market was not addressing these contaminated areas. There's a number of them, and again, the voluntary investigation and cleanup unit at the PCA could share those numbers with you, and they'd be fairly eye-popping. But they just sit. The sites sit, and they not only don't develop themselves, but they have a negative impact on the areas that surround them as well. Again, it's the issue that Mr. Crosby brought up in the civil law committee. Why should I reinvest in my property? Why should I continue to invest in my property when this stuff across the street is having such a negative impact?
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Johnson,
could I just address that issue, because I mentioned earlier, and Representative Ellison and I have also talked about this today. The definition of, first of all, you don't have to prove that it's absolutely necessary to take a contaminated area. You have to prove it's absolutely necessary to take a non-contaminated area along with the contaminated area. So that doesn't come into the question here. What I think is a fair question is, under our definition, have we made it too difficult? Have we made the definition, the bar too high for something to fall under the exception of environmental contamination? And we are working right now with Representative Thiessen and a couple of other folks, actually, who testified in civil law, to make sure we got the right language. My intent on this was not to say 50% of land mass, but 50% of the parcels that you're taking have to have some level of contamination in that, which is quite, I think it's probably a different standard. We're working on that, and I think that's a fair question to ask.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, I don't really have a question. I wonder if you reserve any time for emotional outbursts or comments?
No.
Of course.
Later.
All right.
But not much later, I can assure you. Representative, did you have a question? Questions, yes, and amendments, because we do want to get to those. Thank you, Mr. Jamboy. We have three, our time that I allotted at the outset for equal and fair response by the opposition has now expired.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I would just like to point out that your packets include a letter from Mark Foreman that might provide a different perspective on his testimony. Thank you.
But we do have three additional testifiers. If you want, and if you want to restrict yourself to 1 minute each, you may come forward now. Mr. Streeter, you choose to testify. Thank you. Have a seat. Give us your name. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Bob Streeter. I'm the Community Development Director for the City of Columbia Heights. I'm here today to speak specifically to two items, one that I'm only going to have enough time for, and that's the environmental definition in the bill. You have in your possession this handout. The second page of this handout takes this bill and compares and asks the question, would we qualify as environmentally contaminated under this bill? The answer is no. And if you look in the first two columns, under this bill there are two tests. One, that surface area of contamination needs to exceed 50%. The second test is that the cost of remediation needs to exceed 100% of the estimated market value. As you see in those columns, none of the properties do. If you look further to the left or to the right, you're going to see the actual contamination that does exist. Even though these properties are not environmentally contaminated under this bill, you're going to see that there are 49,000 cubic yards of contamination. That's 2,700 semi-truckloads full of contamination, and it's cost $1.6 million to clean up. If you look at the entire site, which is a 30-acre redevelopment of an industrial site, largely for residential and some commercial, you're going to see that only 36.4% of the surface area is contaminated, and the cost to remediate it only equals 88% of the estimated market value, even though we took 131,000 cubic yards of contaminated soil out of the ground. That's 250 semi-truckloads per acre. This does not include the contaminated regional groundwater table. You're also going to see it costs $4.5 million.
Your time is up. Could you conclude, please?
This bill is going to stop redevelopment. I agree with Mr. Brunhofer.
Thank you. Mr. Mark Sather, did you want to say a word for a minute?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. You have a packet of information, or in your packet is some information from the League of Cities that shows a case study from White Bear Lake. My name is Mark Sather. I'm the city manager of White Bear Lake. And I just would like to ask you to focus on a couple of things. You've heard a lot of references here today about economic development. I'd like to ask you to seriously remember the redevelopment side. White Bear Lake is proudly celebrating its 125th anniversary since it was incorporated. It's an old city. It was a city long before it was a suburb. And when we meet with our residents, in the top five assets that they strongly believe in or value in our community are our schools, our lake, and our downtown. About 13 years ago, our downtown was 40% vacant. And this was due to the influence of large regional malls, large boxes, and so forth. So this issue isn't just about big government stepping in and buying property. It isn't about big businesses coming in. Many times it's small mom-and-pop stores. That's what our downtown is. It's many small businesses, and we have a case study in it that shows about a major redevelopment. It took a great number of years to get done, required acquisition of several different properties, a lot of relocation, and in the end, it was very successful. Our downtown is full. There's very few, if any, vacancies right now. All of the businesses that were relocated, with the exception of one, is still in business in White Bear Lake today. And we'd argue that it was, in fact, Sam's Club that took that business out of business and through their competition. So I'd ask you to, again, really remember that. The question that I'd ask, or the point I'd like to make also, and I'm sorry, I'm just totally deviating from my script, is that redevelopment project in our case study would not work under this law. And if I had time, I could go through all the detail, but it has a lot to do with the definition of blight, mostly to do with the definition of blight and that 50% threshold and how it is defined. And you have pictures in there. There's a lot of detail. You heard before the people speaking from the in favor of it. You'd like to hear the message from the trenches. We could give you messages from the trenches to show how hard it is to do these redevelopment projects the way they are now. And with these added hurdles, it won't be done. And so it isn't just keeping the big box from coming in and squeezing out the mom-and-pa stores. It's allowing a lot of little family businesses, many second, third, fourth generations, to stay in business by helping them clean up the blighted stuff. Most of our redevelopment was businesses that were located on railroad property that they had a 30-day notice in their lease that they had to vacate. Each of those businesses now own the land in which they own the building, and they own the land on which their business is located.
And if we could have gotten to here today, I'm sure they would all say they're far better off than where they were before, living on property where it made very little sense to reinvest in the property. That's why some of the pictures you see are of very poor quality in terms of maintenance. When they don't own the land that the buildings are on, there's not a lot of incentive to fix it up when the railroad can give you 30 days to get off the problem.
Thank you, Mr. Sadler.
Thank you.
I mean, Mr. Streeter, excuse me, I jumped ahead. Next, if you'd like a minute as well, Mr. Dan Klein, Office of Anoka County Attorney. If you're here, please come forward.
Thank you.
Good morning, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dan Klein. I'm an assistant Anoka County Attorney. I've been representing the county in eminent domain cases for the last 20 years. Primarily in right-of-way acquisition for the highways. I know this is primarily focused on redevelopment and those type of kilo issues, but I wanted to make sure that you guys understood the effect that this current this legislation as currently drafted would have on right-of-way acquisitions. Corrine Thompson highlighted the problems with the attorney fees and the game plan. Currently, we negotiate at least 80% or probably 75 to 85% of our cases before they even get to the commissioner's hearing. After the commissioner's hearing, we get less than 2% that go to trial. Generally, most of our stuff is done through negotiations. The attorney fee provisions and how it's structured would definitely fall into the game playing aspects as outlined by Ms. Thompson. The second thing was the going concern value and the flip-flop of the who has to prove what, and the heightened clear and convincing standard. That would be very difficult for the county to prove since we do not have access to their books or their business practices. But I won't go into that anymore. Ms. Thompson did a good job of outlining that. But with regard to the going concern issue, Section 6 contains a definition of going concern. I'm not sure what the purpose of that definition is. To me, it seems to be expanding the case law definition of what is going concern, what is the going concern value, and what may be compensable under this new statute. It'd be important for practitioners to know if that definition is expanding what is compensable, or is just trying to reiterate what is compensable under a loss of going concern. To me, it looks like they're greatly expanding what may be compensable under the law. And if that's the case, it would be important to clarify what those items are so that we know rather than having to argue it out at the commissioner's level and in district court. With that, I think I'll conclude my comments. I know you're short of time. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Any questions? I see none. Extend our greetings from the committee, Mr. Clint, to Bob Johnson, your county attorney. Thank you. One last unannounced witness from the Department of Transportation. Somebody indicated they chose to testify. Please step forward. Are you taking a seat? Is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify on this? Please raise your hand now. I see none. Give us your name, ma'am, and go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Betsy Parker from the Department of Transportation. I'm not here to oppose the bill. The administration supports eminent domain reform. But since this is a fiscal committee, I'm only here to tell you what we think the bill would cost NINDOT, because we are the largest acquirer of property in the state. And if you enact this bill as it is, we will comply with this bill as we now comply with existing law that determines how we compensate landowners from whom we acquire land. One of the earlier speakers said that government does not pay relocation benefits, and I would just like to correct that misimpression. We do pay relocation and business reestablishment benefits. And in 2005, MnDOT alone paid $4.6 million in relocation benefits. We estimate that under this bill, the attorney fee and expert witnesses provisions would cost the department about $14 million a year. If those provisions had been in effect in 2005, we would have paid over $4 million in attorney's fees. I know that sounds like a lot of money, but to put that in context, in 2005 we acquired about 800 parcels. We made direct payments to landowners for the value of the land alone exceeding $70 million, and then we paid over $6 million in relocation, business reestablishment, housing supplements, and other benefits that are now required by law to be paid to landowners. We based our estimate of $14 million on the number of cases in 2005 that went into eminent domain and where there was an award or a settlement in excess of the 20% provided in this bill. We haven't yet developed an estimate of the probable increased cost of the loss of going concern because we don't pay that very often, although we do pay it sometimes. And now we pay it whenever we put a business out of business and they cannot be relocated. I found we don't keep separate records of paying loss of going concern like we do for other things, but I've had people scouring records, and we have paid it, for example, where a gas station couldn't be relocated because the city wouldn't grant it, where a city wouldn't issue a liquor license, where a salvage yard existed and we acquired it and they were operating under a non-conforming use permit. So we do pay that now, and I'll be happy to... we've been talking with the author and other persons concerned with this bill, and we'll continue to do so.
Thank you, Ms. Parker. Representative Johnson, I'm sorry, question, excuse me, more than one question. Representative Hillstrom, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is actually a procedural question. Given the fact that this is policy, but it has a significant potential of significant fiscal impact, will there be a fiscal note done on this bill? Will there be another fiscal place that this bill will be going to? Or can you kind of explain what the process is going to be?
Representative Johnson, you go first.
And Mr. Chairman, we're going to Transportation Finance, which I think would be the only conceivable fiscal impact.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, there's another fiscal impact on page 4, section 5. Lines 4.22.4.24.
Representative Johnson.
And Mr. Chairman, as I've already indicated, I think there may be an amendment to take that piece out.
So on the strength of the Transportation Finance Department and FAITH, can we proceed? I'm concerned as well, but I picked up from your opening comments, and now you've confirmed that it would appear that, well, I'm not going to present your bill for you, but if you have any additional questions, I'm beginning to ramble. Representative Hillstrom.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. This is actually an issue that hasn't been discussed, and again, I'm going to see this in local government. I was on a city council, and I participated in eminent domain procedures. And one of the things that I learned at one of the hearings I was at is that there is a benefit to landowners, business owners who participate or have their land taken from them when redevelopment is going to happen, because they then have 2 years to reinvest their capital gains. Whereas if it is simply sold, they are not, there's a shorter period of time. So I hope that you'll be able to talk about that a little bit at another hearing. And the other thing is one of the issues that we ran into as well is that many times current landowners are involved in long-term leases. And so if they even want to redevelop their own property, if they have long-term leases, sometimes they do come to the city and talk to them about taking the property to allow for redevelopment, especially if there's maybe another parcel next door that they need to take. And my city is currently going through a lawsuit regarding one property that was kind of the case. There was originally going to be a joint agreement about doing some eminent domain proceedings they couldn't come to agreement on the amount of money, and a parcel next door was going to need to be taken. And then when the deal fell apart, of course, the landowner who owned the property no longer wanted eminent domain done to his property, because he wanted to keep it. But so these get very, very complicated sometimes, and I certainly would hope that at some point we'll be able to talk about that.
Other questions at this time? Let's move to the amendments. We do have three, I'm aware of three authors offering amendments, and I would suggest or propose that we hear them in the following order. Representative Johnson, you must be aware of them. If this is acceptable to you, Representative Newman first, then Ellison, then Paymar. What's your pleasure?
It doesn't matter to me. That order is fine, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would offer the it's AO6113 amendment, which is compensation for removal of legal non-conforming use. This amendment deals specifically with what's called inverse condemnation, where a governmental entity enters a by regulation or ordinance effectively or affects the value of property and is considered a taking. And in this particular amendment, where the governmental entity or the authority requires removal of a legal non-conforming use as a condition for issuance of a permit, that would not be permitted unless the authority agrees to pay just compensation for the taking. So it isn't actually a taking for purposes of taking away ownership, but rather it's a taking by regulation. And I would offer that amendment.
Representative Johnson, your response.
Mr. Chairman, I would support this amendment.
Any questions from any member of the committee? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Also, my community has done some of this. There's housing, for example, along a very busy street through my community, and it's probably not a good idea to continue to have housing as the traffic continues to grow. It becomes less and less safe for people to live in the community. We've started to hear members of the community coming forward saying that their children are having more instances of asthma or those kinds of things. And so the city did kind of an overlay of the property saying that, you know, in the future, housing ought not be rebuilt. And in the event of a fire, you ought not rebuild the housing. So would that then count as a taking, and the city, when they did that, would then have to pay out the value of the property for all of the houses along that road? Is that what this says?
Representative Newman.
I'm not sure if I understand the question completely, so I'll answer it in this fashion. Sometimes governmental bodies or ordinances enact regulations which affect the directly affect the use of private property, and this amendment takes into consideration one of those types of ordinances or regulations, and it isn't designed to restrict the ability of the government to enact ordinances or regulations or take the property. Rather, it is an amendment that is designed to compensate an owner if the government or the authority enacts such a regulation. So I think that it would, in your scenario, would really be up to the local governing body to determine whether or not their ordinance is proper for the purposes that you have outlined. But if they decide to do that, and it limits the ability of the property owner to use their property, then this amendment would indicate that the authority has to compensate the owner for the loss.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So would this then be implemented for current standing ordinances, or would this be future overlays that are placed, so is it retroactive or is it from the date it passes into law? Any changes to zoning ordinances?
Representative Newman.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I would not anticipate that this amendment would have any retroactive effect. It would be my view that, frankly, retroactive laws are improper, and that this amendment would be prospective in nature and be applied in the future.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to, you know, get a really good understanding before we vote on this, because, for example, I have a house in my neighborhood where I grew up that the woman has been attempting to sell her home as a commercial property for many, many years, because the city stated that along this road, Brooklyn Boulevard, that it should not be residential housing anymore. She can't sell her property. She hasn't been able to fix up the property. There are many things that she hasn't been able to do. And it has been a sticking point in my community for many, many years. Some people say the city should have just bought her out. Some people say that she just ought to sell it for a lower price. So because it's still kind of ongoing and she still is trying to sell her property and she can't, would the city be responsible for buying that house now if this becomes law?
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hillstrom, I'm not sure that I would be comfortable with giving you a legal opinion on that issue.
Okay.
But I would direct your attention to the amendment where we are talking about the issuance of a permit which is conditioned upon the removal of an existing structure. I honestly can tell you I don't know whether or not this amendment would dovetail or be even applicable in the scenario that you are outlining, because it's an ongoing apparently situation. So I just don't know enough about that fact to even comment on it.
Any further discussion, Representative Ellison?
Mr. Chair, Representative Newman, would this amendment have a fiscal impact?
Representative Newman, do you have an answer or not?
I don't know, Mr.
Okay.
Chairman. I was thinking, thank you. I don't know.
Okay.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Ellison.
Is it possible that maybe one of our esteemed staff might know if this would have a fiscal impact?
Mr. Carter, do you want to respond?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, I do not know either. We might have to, we'd have to probably ask the agencies if it would.
All we could do is, depending on whether, if it doesn't get attached, it's not a problem. If it does, at the risk of irritating the fiscal note department grinder outers, we'll ask them for a fiscal note, and if it produces one, we'll decide whether we want to rehear this in this committee.
And Mr. Chairman?
Representative Johnson.
This would only have a potential fiscal impact based upon a decision of a city to do something which would create that fiscal impact. So it's not just this is not something we're requiring of anybody. It would be based upon a decision by city government to require somebody to remove something, and then it would cost them money.
But Mr. Chair, I guess I'm in the situation where I don't know enough about the impact of this amendment to truly make an informed decision. In that case, I think it's sometimes better to slow down and just sort of, and not go forward until you know what it really, really means. So, I don't know. Is it possible? I think this bill is going to go to how many other committees, Mr. Chair?
Four.
At least four.
My thought is maybe the better part of wisdom here is to just sort of let us get a better feel for what this is going to mean down the line. That's just a comment. That's all I got.
Representative Ellison, the chair has the power and authority to request a fiscal note on a bill that's left our committee, and I will do so if this amendment is attached. If there's a problem, We'll find out. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also, it might be a little more difficult to get, but a local fiscal note, because ultimately if this is going to be a city or a county expense or a township expense, I would bet that this is something that we should at least have some sense of how widespread it would be.
Representative Hillstrom, that's a good thought. I think it's the same process. I also have noted in the past townships and locals have not hesitated to tell us when things cost money. Representative Johnson? If there's no further discussion, we are on the Newman Amendment. No further discussion on the Newman Amendment. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails, and that is adopted. Anything else? If not, Representative Newman, anything further?
Nothing
Representative
further.
Ellison.
Mr. Chair, should I just start picking them up in any order that I choose? Or
please, please.
Your Honor, let me first of all, Mr. Chair, let me first of all refer to the H2846A15 amendment. 15. This amendment, if you compare it to your bill, would eliminate this section that would provide de novo review to the court at the Court of Appeals level of the decision, whatever trial court decision is made. Let me make sure I get where I want to go. Yeah, that's the intention of this amendment. I have spoken to the author, and I think that the author's all right with it. We might as well start out on a good note.
Representative Johnson, is that acceptable to you?
It is, Mr. Chairman.
If there's no discussion, then on the amendment, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. That amendment's adopted. Representative Ellison, anything else?
I got a few more, Mr. Chair.
Go right ahead.
Mr. Chair, now the 810 amendment. I mean, the 810 amendment. The 810 amendment, if you compare it to your bill, essentially would state that in order to, you know, it would alter the definition of a blighted area. At this point, the bill says that a blighted area means that at the time of the commendation that it is zoned for urban use, and that where more than 50% of the buildings are dilapidated, and it goes on to define dilapidated as including, among other things, unfit for human use. And members, the concept here is that a neighborhood or a community is in deep trouble way before we ever get to 50% of the houses being dilapidated. When we get 50% of the houses being dilapidated, we have a neighborhood that basically looks like a war zone. And I'm not speaking theoretically. I'm speaking in a practical way. I think that a city or a taking entity ought to be able to step in and take property way before we get to the point where half the houses are unfit. And I think, you know, going back on what the mayor of Maplewood said, that, you know, cities ought to act proactively before we get to 50%, I think I agree with her. But I also think that lowering the threshold to 20% is probably a better place. Again, imagine the kind of neighborhood we're talking about. We're talking about a neighborhood where, you know, half the houses are dilapidated. Who's going to live there? Probably poor people. And what condition are they going to be living in? Severely substandard housing. What kind of elements is that going to attract? Well, if you're trying to sell dope, that's a good place to do it because nobody cares, or it doesn't appear to, based on the physical structures around. So my point is this: lowering the threshold to 20% would allow the government to step in at a point where it could still reasonably start turning that neighborhood around. Whereas 50%, we might as well just torch the whole neighborhood because it'll just be a destroyed community. I offer that and hope urge member support.
Representative Johnson, your position on the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I don't support the amendment. But just keep in mind this 50%. You can take any building that's dilapidated, you can take. The question is, how often can you make the ones that aren't? the parts that aren't blighted. And what we're saying is if it's more than half blighted, you can take, if you can show it's absolutely necessary, you can take the non-blighted ones too. This is saying that if you've got 20% dilapidated buildings and the rest of them are fine, you can still take 80%, that there's nothing wrong with for economic development. I just think that's too easy.
Further discussion on the 810 amendment. If not, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Next, Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, what I have next is the A11 amendment. The A11 amendment, just to explain it, if you just try to match it up with your bill real quickly, it basically what it does is it eliminates, under this definition of dilapidated, it eliminates the language involving is unfit for human use. And so what the remaining definition would be if the committee adopts this amendment would be that the dilapidated building means that it was inspected by local government and cited for one or more building code violations within the last 12 months before the condemnation is commenced, and then two, in which the building code violations cited have not been remedied as determined by at least one reinspection that finds noncompliance after the due date for the compliance. And so this definition would say that this place has building code violations and the owner is not compliant with trying to fix them. It puts the power in the hand of the owner, it basically removes the idea that what I think would make almost no house, dilapidated, unless it was truly crumbling down to the ground. It takes out this idea that the house would have to be unfit for human use because, and you all can read the language. So the unfit for human use language, I think, is not defined in statute or case law anywhere that I've been able to determine. And I think it essentially makes the threshold too high for showing that a house is dilapidated. So I urge your support.
Representative Johnson, your position?
Mr. Chairman, I don't support this amendment. I think it creates a very low standard for blight.
Discussion on the amendment. Any further discussion? If not, on the Ellison amendment, those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion does not prevail. Amendment is not adopted. Anything else? Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, on the A13 amendment, speaks to this. Let me get there on my sheet. If you match it up on page 3, it would essentially delete lines 19 through 21, which say that a public use, the idea here is that for the purpose, it defines public use or public purpose to mean, and then it has a few definition spots there, but this amendment would say that a public benefits of economic development, including an increase in the tax base, tax revenues, employment, general economic health, do not by themselves constitute a public use or public purpose. It eliminates those lines. And members, if you happen to live in a community where there's plenty of employment, God bless you. If you happen to live in a community where that has a strong tax base, God bless you. If you have a healthy community, I'm envious of you, and we should get together and talk about how we can replicate that all over North Minneapolis. But when you represent a district where 15% of the people are unemployed, where 30% of the people do not own cars, where child poverty, where one out of three black children are in poverty, you cannot tie the hands of a community and tell them they can't improve it, and tell them that improving the employment and the economic viability of that neighborhood is not a public purpose. It absolutely is a public purpose. And I would urge you to consider adopting this amendment, because what it would mean, it wouldn't raise the bar as our colleague wants to do for taking. But what it would do is it would rekindle the idea that you can improve a community through use of eminent domain, and that giving somebody an economic opportunity, a job, and to be a tax payer is a valuable and noteworthy thing for which to use eminent domain. So I do urge your support.
Representative Ellison, look at your amendment, the last line. You need to change 19 to 21 to read 18 to 20, don't you? Ms. Dyson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Ellison, I apologize. The pre-engrossment had a different page and line alignment, and I didn't have the official engrossment when I did it, so it's actually both of them. It should be page 3, line 11, and then page 3, delete lines 18 to 20.
Without objection, we'll just note the change and correction then on that Ellison amendment.
That's right, Mr. Chair, but the substance of what I'm proposing is the same.
Right. Representative Johnson, your response, please.
Mr. Chairman, I don't support this. This essentially would leave the Kelo ruling in place in Minnesota.
Discussion on the Ellison amendment. Further discussion? If not, those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion does not prevail. Amendment's not adopted. Anything else?
Yep, got a few more, Mr. Chair. Now picking up the A14. The A14 amendment. The A14 amendment would take out this term. You know, there's this term of art in the bill, absolutely necessary, absolutely necessary. And this
excuse me, Representative Ellison, before you proceed, same problem with the numbering. Ms. Dyson, is that correct? And we'll just play like we've got the right numbers on your amendment. Okay.
Mr. Chair, yes, the pre-engrossment page and line apparently is different.
Okay. Well, without objection, the corrections will be noted in the record. Go ahead on the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In this area where we're talking about blight, where we're talking about environmental contamination, public, not public nuisance, I don't think, but the other recognized area where taking can occur, there is this heightened threshold, this absolutely necessary language. And again, it's not defined in the case law. It's not defined in the statute anywhere. And I have listened to and heard the author's explanation as to how he came to this language. But absolutely necessary. You know, I'm not sure that anything is absolutely necessary other than death and taxes. And I think so. It basically says that you cannot take property for these purposes unless it's absolutely necessary. I have no idea what that means. It sounds pretty ominous to me. And I think what we need to do is introduce a more reasonable standard and just let it be let the term necessary be stand alone without the modifier. If you adopt this amendment, it will help protect property, private property owners, but it will at least allow takings to not have such an enormous threshold to overcome. So I'd urge your support.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, I don't support this amendment. Keep in mind that this absolutely necessary standard is for, again, non-blighted or non-contaminated areas that you want to pull in with the environmentally contaminated or blighted areas. And my definition of absolutely necessary is there's no other option but to pull in this non-damaged area as well. So I think it's a high standard, but we need a high standard.
Further discussion on this amendment, if there is none. Those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No. No.
Motion does not prevail. Amendment is not adopted. Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, now I'd like members to divert their attention to focus their attention on the A16 amendment. The A16 amendment is would essentially get the clear and convincing standard and replace it with preponderance of the evidence. Now, members, you know, we're kind of on a roll in the wrong direction here from my standpoint.
But we are on a roll.
And, you know, this is one that I do want to encourage everybody to look at very carefully. Now, right now, and I think the authors made this clear, the legal standard is, and I would agree, too low. Essentially, you know, if the taking authority says it, the court is to apply a standard of essentially substantial deference, meaning that if the taking authority wants to do it, it's good enough for us. That's essentially the standard that has been applied now. That provides the property owner with basically no no real recourse in the court because it's already been decided by the taking authority that they did it. Therefore, the court says that there's substantial deference applied. So what I'm saying is, let's not kick over. Let's go up to the next logical, the next reasonable standard in American law, which is a preponderance of the evidence. This bill represents, if you adopt this, it represents a change and an improvement and a protection for private property owners. Why? Because now the threshold is so low. What this does is raise it up to a reasonable standard, a standard that is recognized in American law for civil cases. Now, I will say this, and me and the author don't, you know, me and Representative Johnson don't necessarily see this issue the exact same way, but I think we agree in general that a clear and convincing standard is often associated with a liberty interest, where you're going to get locked up, your probation is going to be revoked. Some of the other attorneys will recognize this standard from that context. And then there are other frameworks in which it's invoked, such as whether or not a judge is going to be disciplined, whether or not a person is going to be committed. Generally, some kind of liberty interest involved. Fraud, something that is criminal. It might be civil, but it's criminal in nature. It's a high standard of proof because it involves this. And I would say that in a civil case, which this is, and every lawyer here will tell you that condemnation proceedings are civil, we should apply a civil standard. And in order to solve a problem, in order to protect private property owners, which I think is meritorious and good thing to do, we don't want to overreach. And I would urge the committee to convince this preponderance standard. It is an improvement over the status quo. If you want more protection, it is that. So, I urge your support.
Representative Johnson, your position?
Mr. Chairman, I don't support this amendment. We had this discussion in civil law as well, and we do use clear and convincing evidence in civil cases. I gave some examples there with respect to a couple First Amendment instances, a Second Amendment instance that we just recently passed, the employer reference law. We put clear and convincing evidence in there and had a big discussion about that. And when you're talking about the Fifth Amendment rights to people to not have their homes taken away from them by government, I think a very high standard is a good thing.
Further discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Chairs in doubt, show of hands. Those in favor, please raise your hand. Those opposed, raise your hand. 7-5, the motion does not pass, the amendment is not adopted. Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, now I'd like to focus the committee's attention on A-12. Now this is the, Mr. Chair, this amendment, the A-12 amendment, addresses the question of environmentally contaminated. I'm not sure where the gentleman was from, but he showed us the map, the city of Columbia Heights, in which this clearly contaminated area simply didn't meet the threshold. Only 88% of the value the cost of the cleanup was only 88% of the value of the land, and only a smaller percentage than 50 was the contamination that covered the surface. As I've researched the origin of this definition, I found that there really is, this definition is not related to science, it's not related to anything really, really rational, it doesn't reflect the real world of environmental cleanup. So, members, what I've done is said, look, where in Minnesota law have we already looked at the question of environmentally contaminated, and we've done that in D. And we've had a representative from D here. And so what I did is I plucked up the definition that deed applies for environmental cleanup and simply cited to that, so that we're not using a definition that has not stood the test of time, that courts have not had a chance to look at, that we're using a definition that we've already sort of passed on as a sensible definition. And it's already in Minnesota law, and I believe this these references to the environmental contaminated in the deed statute have been around for quite a number of years and haven't been overturned. So that's the thing we should use. I would ask that the committee members support the amendment.
Representative Johnson, your response.
Mr. Chairman, I don't support the amendment, and it's not all that substantive, but as I think I've said three or four times already, I recognize that we need to improve this language, and we're working right now with Representative Thiessen and a few other people to try to come up with correct language. I'm not necessarily opposed to this. This might be an option, but I would prefer not to change it right now, so I would ask for a no vote.
Further discussion? If not on the amendment, those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No. No.
Motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair.
How many more do you have, sir?
Well, Mr. Chair, I only have two more. I think I have three more. And I can actually, I only have two more, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Now, Mr. Chair, I just want to say, I'm sure that somebody has been thinking, you know, Ellison he got the first one and lost every other one. Why didn't he just quit while he's way behind? And my thought is this, this is my last chance to try to improve this bill. Mr. Chair and members, I want to vote for this bill. I believe that private property owners should be protected. I don't think they have enough protection now. There are certain provisions that I would like to see changed. I think we are overreacting. Now, everybody in this room has been promised, hey, I recognize the problem you're identifying, we're going to work with you. And sometimes you get worked with, and sometimes you don't. This is my chance to try to be heard on this bill. So I am going to ask for your individual judgment on these last two amendments, and that's all it's going to be. And would urge us not to just vote party line, as it looks like we're doing. The A8 Amendment, Mr. Chair, is my second to the last one, my penultimate amendment. The A8 Amendment. The A8 Amendment, again, tries to fix this idea of what a dilapidated... of
Representative Ellison, I apologize, we couldn't hear here. A8? 8A.
Right, I transposed.
Okay,
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
8A.
Thank you.
8A deals with... condemnation for blighted areas. It speaks to non-dilapidated buildings in areas of blight mitigation and reasonable necessity. What it says is it goes back to this idea of it looks at the idea of absolute necessity. It's stronger than just necessity, but it's not as limiting as absolute necessity. It's reasonably necessary, and it takes a middle road. Also, it looks at the question of contaminated property. In taking property to remediate environmental contamination, the condemning authority must not take uncontaminated parcels unless it is reasonably necessary. So, again, it's trying to go for a middle standard. We'd urge your support.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, I don't support this amendment for really the same reasons of just the earlier amendment where we just wanted to delete the word absolutely. I don't see how reasonably necessary is really a stronger standard than just plain old necessary myself.
Additional discussion? If not, those in favor of the amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No. No.
Motion does not prevail. Amendment's not adopted.
Last one, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, this amendment looks at this environmental contaminated area and just changes one little word. I'm sorry, A18. Just changes one word. And the word that we're trying to change is that you see that when you get to environmental contamination, it is, Mr. Chair, you have to prove both 50% surface area and you have to prove that the cost of cleanup exceeds 100% of the assessor's estimated market value. Got to prove both of those things. This amendment would say, let's just let that only one or the other would have to be proved. 50% contaminated, everybody would agree that's a pretty high threshold, or the other. And again, this amendment is just trying to give safety authorities a little bit more flexibility. You know, in the final analysis, you know, nobody in Minnesota wants to create a slum. If cities can, or taking entities cannot take to redevelop in the area of environmental contamination, what is going to happen is that the people who live in that contaminated area are going to have to just live with that contamination. And that contamination, those people are probably going to be, they're going to be in an economic situation where they really can't live anywhere else. And so we're going to be saying that our lowest income citizens are going to be relegated to living near the dirtiest, most contaminated spots in our state. And that's wrong. So I'm asking that you would allow this amendment and support this amendment in order to try to rectify that. So, Mr. Chair, that's the A18 amendment, and I urge your support.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, I don't support this amendment, and it just we are trying to fix this language. I don't think changing the "and," I think we've done something a little wrong here, and I don't think making it an "or" will solve that. But you simply give me the courtesy as author of working with my second author, Representative Thiessen, and fixing this piece. This won't do it.
Any discussion, further discussion on the amendment? If not, those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion does not prevail. The amendment's not adopted. Representative Ellison, I don't usually, and nor will I now, debate or argue. I prefer to just conduct the meeting, try to get us through on time. You did make one comment, though, about voting with you on the First Amendment, and that it was voting party line afterwards. Representative Ellison, I voted with you on the First Amendment because your first one had merit.
Well, Mr. Chair, you know, I didn't mean to provoke the chair into a partisan conversation. I would submit that each one of my amendments was highly meritorious, and all of you should have voted with me on each one.
Representative Paymer, do you choose to offer some amendments?
No.
All right, very good. All right, committee, the bill then is before us for discussion as amendment, House file 2846 as amendment. But before we go to the vote, we will take 10 seconds if Cornish needs to vent. Or are we done with that?
Well, no, it wasn't a vent. It was, I just wanted to let the committee know that I think the one thing that's different about this bill and the promises and the faith that was intended from here is that the difference in the author. The same thing was said about the meth bill. The house was going to fall in, the sky was falling into the world, and Representative Johnson took it on, was very good about making accommodations and amendments on, and I think satisfied a lot of people eventually, overwhelmed passage. The other thing is, you don't know unless you've been on the end of one of these, what it's really like. I'm glad that we've waited it the other way, because years ago, just a small instance where I walked out into this guy on my porch and said he was going to take this big, huge, beautiful tree out of my yard, an eminent domain, and after I told him all the bad things would happen to him if he did, he went down to my landlord and scared him and said that they could take the whole house if they wanted to. Well, they took the tree, and then they went down to a richer person down the line and just topped the evergreen trees in their yard. They didn't take a single one of them. And this bill has been applied, this procedure in the past has been applied willy-nilly, and it's not who or know or what you know. And so I think this evens it out, and I'm glad it's lopsided the other way and it's got the attention of governments now, and maybe it'll make more of an even playing field, because it certainly was annexation and eminent domain has been abused too long, and I'm glad you brought the bill before us, Representative Johnson. Thank you.
Any further comments?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, I'm going to be voting for your bill today. I, too, am in a very interesting position, as I served on a city council and I participated in eminent domain. And then I had a family member who was, eminent domain was threatened to be used against them. So I have seen both sides of the coin, and I appreciate your willingness to talk with me as well about the issues. And so I'll be voting in favor of it, and hopefully we'll be able to work out some of these issues before we get to a local government.
Any other discussion? I'll just offer a comment. I wasn't kidding when I said that this committee has some of the best minds in the House. I firmly believe that. And we've had an excellent discussion here today. I want to thank you all, committee, because we've met now going on 4 hours without a break. We've done, I don't know that we've done that in the past, but you've lived up to high expectations, and we've had good comments, good discussion, good amendments, good discussion of amendments, whether they passed or failed, and frankly, I trust that, and I hope that what this committee has put together, no other committee will split asunder, because I think you've got a reasonable bill at this point. We're going to take a vote right now. If there's no other discussion on the bill as amended, those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no.
No.
The motion prevails. The bill is passed as amended and re-referred to Committee on Local Government. Thank you, committee. This meeting is adjourned.